This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Ann Kelsey on the 27th of March 2001 at approximately 8:35 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Ann Kelsey is in Whippany, New Jersey. Ma'am, why don't we go ahead and start by you talking briefly about your early life, when and where you were born, where you grew up.
I was born in Kokomo, Indiana, June 20th, 1946, and I left there about six months after I was born, moved to Washington, D.C. My father got a job after he was discharged from the Navy, working for the Navy as a civilian. We were there until 1951. My brother was born in 1950. In 1951, he was transferred to California to the Naval Ordnance Laboratory, and we moved to Riverside, and that is where I grew up and essentially where I consider my hometown. And I went to elementary school, junior high school in Riverside, went to the university, graduated from high school in 1964, went to the University of California at Riverside, got my BA in 1968, anthropology and English, double major, and then went to library school at UCLA in 1969, and then to Vietnam in the fall of 1969.
Okay. Was there anything, especially growing up in the type of environment you did, where you were exposed to the military, did that have an impact on you?
Yes. Oh, yeah. California, the military was all over California. Mm-hmm. And there was a Strategic Air Command base, March Air Force Base in Riverside. And, of course, my father worked at a military installation, a small mm-hmm. one. There was just Navy, Marines, Air Force, Army, all around me. Mm-hmm. Most of the people I knew, their parents were in the military mm-hmm. or worked for the military. Mm-hmm. So the military was just a normal situation. It was a normal situation to have mm-hmm. friends with parents on alert. Going on alert was just like going to the shoe store. Mm-hmm. The B-52 bombers would take off every morning, mm-hmm. and the noise would pretty much stop everything for 2 or 3 minutes while they took off, and that was normal. People built bomb shelters, and that was perfectly normal. Mm-hmm. So it was being in that kind of an environment was the normal state of affairs as far even for those of us who didn't have families who were military.
Mm-hmm. When you were growing up there, how did that affect you in terms of your concern over security of your life, security of the world, really? Did you understand how this fit into the Cold War?
Oh, I don't think I really did. I don't really remember the Bay of Pigs as being, a time of real terror. I remember Kennedy's assassination. Mm-hmm. But no, I don't think so. I don't think I had a real grip on the Cold War, mm-hmm. on the threat of Russians dropping a bomb. Mm-hmm. I think it was just a normal situation. I mean, it was the way it was. It was how everybody lived. Mm-hmm. The fact that you did bomb drills and dived under desks, once a month in school mm-hmm. was just normal. Mm-hmm. I don't remember having any fears or concerns about being wiped out or anything.
Mm-hmm. Did they talk much about atomic war, nuclear war, while you were in school?
Not that I remember.
Okay. It was just the duck and cover drills, or?
Yeah, duck and cover.
Yeah. Did you ever see the film with the turtle?
The film with the what?
The turtle.
The turtle?
Yeah. The duck and cover turtle?
I don't believe so.
Okay. I was just wondering. It's featured in a film called Atomic Cafe, and they show some of the...
Oh, I've heard of that.
Yeah,
I've heard of that film, but
yeah.
I don't remember ever seeing any, I remember the HUAC movies.
The HUAC movies? Why don't you go ahead and talk about that?
In junior high, they were showing, they had what I now realize were propaganda, films of the House Un-American Activities Committee and the Rosenbergs, and they were newsreels. And I don't exactly remember the context, and I don't remember how the teacher approached these, but the films themselves must have made a deep impression on me, because I still remember that, and that must have been eighth grade. Nobody talked much about McCarthy. I didn't really understand about McCarthy and what happened in the early 50s with the blacklist until I was in college, I'd say. But I certainly remember, you know, Phil Brick and I Led Three Lives and the communist as the Grim Reaper on the horizon, just ready to grab everybody. So while I don't think that I felt personally and immediately threatened by that, I think that did have something to do with why I just automatically supported the government when they went into Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Did your family also support the war?
Good question. I don't know. They got my brother into the National Guard to keep him out of the draft.
Okay.
My parents and I didn't get along real well.
Okay.
At that point in time. Uh-huh. And so we didn't have any substantive discussions on any subject. So I honestly don't know how they felt about the war, whether they supported it or not.
Okay. What about
my father dealt with stuff that some of it still is classified.
Mm-hmm.
And he avoided, and we were taught to avoid, any kinds of discussions that might lead into any potential violations of the Hatch Act.
Mm-hmm.
And we just did that, and we did that in the family as well as outside.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we were taught never to talk about what my father did, who mm-hmm. my father worked for,
mm-hmm.
And we didn't. So that led to not talking about a lot of things that right. might pertain to, you know, things that were happening in terms of the military
mm-hmm.
that my father might have some relationship to.
Okay. Well, certainly most of that's declassified by now. What can you just at least say what your father did and where he worked?
He worked for the Naval Ordnance
okay.
Lab.
Okay, that was what
countermeasures.
It was countermeasures.
Yeah.
Okay.
One thing I know he did was work on the development of the missiles that were fired from the Poseidon submarines.
Okay. And
And he still won't talk about it.
Really?
Flatly refuses.
So you don't know what aspect of the
no.
system he worked on?
No. No idea.
Oh, okay.
He simply won't discuss it.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of his co-workers have tried to do some oral histories and get him to talk, and he won't do it. Just won't do it.
Well, if the co-workers are talking, does that mean the Navy approves of this, or...?
I don't know. It's not being done. He thinks no, and that's why he won't talk.
Okay.
Now, he may not be correct in that. I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, he's 87 years old, and he's been retired since the late 60s.
Okay.
So he's not exactly in the loop
mm-hmm.
in terms of the Department of the Navy. So he may be just, you know, overreacting.
Yeah.
But he definitely refuses to talk about it.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that of course is also a phenomenon, not unique to your father's generation, but is also an issue for many Vietnam veterans.
Oh yes, so. They don't want to talk. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they of course cite security issues as the reason, when in fact most of the stuff is declassified.
Yeah.
And
right.
Openly
oh
available.
Yeah, I ran into somebody last week.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah, just serendipitously. He made a. I said something about being the last plane out of Little Rock during that ice storm Christmas, and he said, oh, like the last plane out of Saigon. Well, you know, most people don't immediately attach that meaning to that particular reference, so I said, oh, when were you there?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, he was there in 75, and he said he was there later, too, but he said, I can't talk about it.
Okay.
So.
What did you think?
What did I think? Well, immediately when I hear that, I immediately think wannabe. Because whenever I hear somebody saying, well, I was near there and I was here and there, but, you know, I can't talk about it. But usually that's followed by talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And usually with stories that are completely off the wall.
Mm-hmm.
But in this person's case, that wasn't the case.
Mm.
You know, we had this very brief discussion in the hallway, and then he truly didn't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
There was no attempt to tell any stories, he just let it stop.
Mm-hmm.
And when I mentioned that I was going to Angkor Wat this summer,
mm-hmm.
his head popped up and his eyes sort of lit up. But he didn't discuss it.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't initiate a conversation. So I'm more inclined to think that maybe, in fact, I said to him, I know people who were in SOG. And he said, well, then you have some idea.
Okay.
So.
It's tough to say.
It's tough to say, right.
Okay. Well, when you were, what year did you enter college? That was 64. So the year you entered college, that was actually the year, technically, the war began in terms of the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And
that's right,
the passage
which I remember nothing about.
Okay.
Nothing about.
Okay, so that was not on your...
That was not on my radar.
Okay.
I don't remember the Gulf of Tonkin. I vaguely remember Diem being assassinated, but that was sort of overshadowed.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably because of the proximity and time to Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
which I remember vividly.
Mm-hmm.
But Vietnam, you know, with hindsight, I keep trying to think, okay, when did Vietnam actually come to my consciousness? And my feeling is it probably was 1966.
Okay.
I really don't remember anything in 64, my first year in college. Really nothing. I don't remember the Gulf of Tonkin, and I don't remember the Marines landing in 65.
Okay. Do you remember what it was in 66 that caught your attention?
I think it probably was. That was when the demonstration started. At UC, at UCR. UCR was and still is, to some extent, a rather unique campus of the University of California. It was very small. It grew out of a citrus experimental station, so it had an agricultural background. It was designed as a small, intimate liberal arts college. Sort of trying to duplicate some of the liberal arts colleges on the East Coast. It had a very, very small enrollment compared to UCLA or UC Berkeley, you know, very small. And most of the people who went there were local. It was although they did have dorms, it was very much a commuter campus. So that the same people, with the same kinds of connections to the military, who I knew in high school, were also at UCR. And as a result, the kind of anti-war activity that had started in Berkeley, you know, much earlier. Only I started to move into UCR in 66. And even then, compared to the other campuses, it was very low-key. But there was demonstrations against Dow Chemical, for example. And that's usually what initiated it. If the recruiters from Dow or military recruiters would come on campus, I mean, this campus was so small it didn't even have a ROTC program. So that would generate some level of demonstrations. And that's when I think that I started to actually be aware of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. That was all, and yeah, that was it. And I remember being very incensed by those demonstrations because, mm-hmm. you know, again, whatever the government was doing was obviously had to be right, and I took it as being a protest against the soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
More than the politics at that point in time. So that's 66 was mm-hmm. probably when I first started to think about Vietnam. It was also when the importance of a, what was it, deferment, 2C,
mm-hmm.
the student deferments
mm-hmm.
started to sort of crystallize, you know, where guys, if their grades weren't high enough, you know, started to be very worried about being drafted. So all of that sort of made me aware
mm-hmm.
of what was happening. People were really starting to worry about the draft then. But, of course, everybody I knew was either a 2C or in the service.
Mm-hmm.
So there weren't too many that were in the middle ground where they were being drafted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my awareness escalated in 67 and 68 because I started dating guys who were in the Air Force and in the Navy and they had been over there or they were going over there, and so then I became very much more aware of mm-hmm. Vietnam then.
Now, I do want to talk about that, but a couple of quick questions. Why Dow Chemical? When they came on campus, why did the students...
Because of napalm.
Okay. And
it was all focused on napalm.
Mm-hmm. And also, why when recruiters would come on, if they were just, I assume that it was like corporate recruiters when
yes,
they show up.
That's right.
Like career day or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
So they would protest when that happened.
Yeah.
Okay.
But then it would, like, you know, mellow out. So there wasn't a consistent level of, it was very, very different from what I encountered in 1969 at UCLA.
Okay. Well, excuse me. Well, let's go ahead and jump back for 1 second. You mentioned earlier that the Diem assassination was overshadowed by JFK's,
mm-hmm.
which JFK's...
Or they were close proximity.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean,
and
it was
so
a couple of weeks.
Maybe I remember Diem because I remember Kennedy so well and all these people starting to get mm-hmm. killed.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was curious. You were probably about 14 when Kennedy came into office. Do you remember that?
Yes.
What did you think? Do you remember?
What did I think?
Yeah. What did you think about Kennedy?
I was very much in favor of Kennedy. I remembered Nixon from California and had no good thoughts about him at all. So I liked Kennedy. I wanted Kennedy to win. But again, this is not something we talked about because government employees aren't allowed to talk about, not allowed to get involved in politics. So we really didn't talk politics in my family. We didn't. There was no participation in any kind of political activity ever. While I was growing up, because you're not allowed to do that. But I personally liked Kennedy, and I remember that that's not what you can do for yourself, what can you can do for your country speech. I remember that very well. And when he started the Peace Corps, I thought that was a wonderful thing. And I was very impressed with Kennedy. I was stricken when he was assassinated.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think when he was assassinated?
Well, I think that I realized that things like that can happen here. I mean, there was a lot of unrest in the Congo, and people were assassinated, and I was aware of all that. But, you don't think that it's going to happen here. And that assassination was clearly... Mm-hmm. Made it clear that, it can happen anywhere. Mm-hmm. And, I was watching television when Ruby shot Oswald, and so, mm-hmm. it was probably the most graphic, as close as I'd been to graphic violence in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely made an impression on me. I remember exactly where I was and what I was doing when they announced that he had been shot, and I remember when he died, mm-hmm. when they announced that.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. I remember the class I was in, where I was sitting. So it obviously made a deep impression on me.
Mm-hmm. Did they interrupted
yes.
your class when all
yes.
those
yes.
events took place?
They I was in Latin. I was in a Latin 4 class.
Mm-hmm.
And they came on with a loudspeaker and said that he had been shot.
Wow.
And then school continued, and we went to the next class, which happened to be, as it happens, a civics class. And then right after that class started, then they announced he had died, and they closed the school down.
Well, okay.
And then we didn't go to school until after the funeral, so it must have been 3 days, 4 days,
wow.
the rest of that week, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was glued to the television.
Mm-hmm. Well, although you couldn't necessarily talk about it, how did your father and your mother respond to it?
I don't remember.
Okay.
Don't remember at all.
Okay. Now, another question about your family, your brother.
Yeah.
Did you and he ever talk about
oh,
the Vietnam
no.
War?
And... Oh, no.
No?
My brother and I don't talk.
Okay.
We maintain a certain level of civility around my parents, but we don't interact.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and talk a little bit more about your time in college. Now, you mentioned that your time at Riverside, although there were some protests in '66, it was relatively calm. And at the same time, you were learning more about the war by dating Air Force airmen and sailors.
Correct.
I guess lived in proximity. For the people who you dated who came back from Vietnam, the ones that had already been, what would they tell you about their Vietnam experience, or would they tell you anything?
Well, the Air Force guys were mostly in Thailand,
mm-hmm.
because in Okinawa, because they were either maintenance crews, B-52 maintenance crews, or they were flying KC-135 tankers.
Mm-hmm.
So they were flying on them. So they were doing refueling. So they were mostly at Utapau and the Cone Phnom,
mm-hmm.
and CCK. They didn't spend time on the ground in Vietnam. So what they would talk about was more about the planes and doing the refueling the B-52s and that kind of thing. So it was, I would say, in hindsight, a very antiseptic view of the war.
Mm-hmm.
The sailors, again, they were Blue Water Navy. They were on LST. The one guy in particular that I dated was on an LST, and he was out of Subic Bay. So they had taken troops over and dropped them, but again hadn't actually gone into Vietnam. So again, it was more of a describing the sail and then describing sailing back home. but really nothing on the ground. I dated one Marine that I actually met on a trip to Hawaii, and he then went over. He was on leave at that time and then went to Vietnam. And he was, and we wrote the whole time he was there. We wrote. And he was from somewhere in the Midwest, the upper Midwest, Michigan or Minnesota, someplace like that. And when he came back, at that time I was at UCLA and I was living in Los Angeles. And he stopped to see me. And I still remember how uncomfortable the whole situation was, that he was clearly completely different from when he went, from the last time I'd seen him before he went over there. And I remember he mentioned something about being a point man, which meant nothing to me then. I mean, I had no idea what a point man was. Mm-hmm. And I have the feeling, and I regret this now, of course, but if I had been able to ask the right questions or to have even recognized some of the things that he was trying to talk about, mm-hmm. that he might have been able to talk about some things and get some things out. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't do that, and the conversation just sort of died away, and he left, and there was no contact after that.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever attempt to make contact, or did he ever attempt?
No. Yeah. No.
Mm-mm. Okay. Did you date anybody else with similar experience?
I did go out with a guy who was again on leave and then went over as a he was in the Army. Mm-hmm. And he was somewhere down in the Delta, and I did write him a while. That was a somebody fixed us up, and he was far more enthused than I was.
Mm-hmm.
And I did write him for a while, but he was starting to get extremely serious. Mm-hmm. And I was in no way, you know, mm-hmm. interested in that. And I'm sure he was describing situations that he was, you know, he must have been a rifleman, mm-hmm. because he was describing situations that I now know would fit with being in a fighting hole. And finally, you know, he kept talking about getting married, and mm-hmm. I essentially said, no, that's not what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some guilt about that because, you know, you feel guilty about writing somebody a quote-unquote dear John, even though there had been no real relationship. You know, but there clearly was in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt very guilty having to cut him off when he was still there, but it was going too far.
Mm-hmm.
And I did, and again, that was the end. You know, I never heard from him again.
Yeah.
But I do remember both their names, and I have looked to see if they're on the wall, and neither of them are, so that's good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, and then when you left Riverside and went up to UCLA, and that was to enroll in the
library school, the master's
mm-hmm.
program, yeah.
How was the tenor there?
Oh, it was awful. It was just awful. That was the summer of 69, and I actually moved there. I moved from Riverside to Los Angeles, and I went on that campus, and SDS was just, like, in full swing, and there were major, major demonstrations and picketing and just everything you can think of going on there, and I was just appalled. I mean, I was just appalled. I was writing this Marine who was over there. I was going out with this Air Force guy who was, going TDYs back and forth from Okinawa and temporary duty. I try to remember to say the words here. You know, I mean, I was just shocked at what was going on. And, you know, they were hanging images of soldiers in effigy. I mean, it was, you know, I had just been completely insulated from this in Riverside. And I was just horrified. And to the point where I stayed in L.A. for one semester, and then and actually this was after this Marine came home. I moved back to Riverside, and I just commuted. And I tried to take classes at night or on the weekend, any time when the level of activity on the campus was likely to be lower. I did. I went to the universities around me in Riverside to do my homework. I spent as little time at UCLA as I possibly could. I was just horribly uncomfortable there. And I didn't interact with anybody. I didn't socialize with anybody. I just went to school, went to my classes, and got out of there. So it was a bad experience, and it was so bad that I didn't even go to graduation.
Wow. Now you your time at UCLA, I guess this was also the transition from your time as a civilian in just a regular context to your time in the Army.
Yeah, that's when they recruited me.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you go ahead and discuss how they recruited you?
Special Services came to the library school in the spring of 69. And I was going to graduate in June of 69. And they were recruiting for Special Services libraries worldwide. They were not there specifically to recruit for Vietnam. They were they wanted librarians for the States, they wanted them for Europe, the other parts of Asia. It was a worldwide recruiting effort. But I was interested anyway, because I just wanted a change.
Mm-hmm.
And so I spent a lot of time talking to them, and, you know, they told me, you know, that you could sign up for, there were 3-year tours, and there were 2-year tours, and there were 1-year tours. And, you know, you could sign up for any one you wanted. And the stateside and Europe, those were all 3 years. Well, I didn't feel like I wanted to commit to 3 years. That was too long. That, you know, if I didn't like it, you know, I'd be stuck. So I just sort of, and Japan was a 3-year tour. That was also 3 years. So I eliminated all of those. And then they talked about the 2-year tours, which were in Asia, and that was, Okinawa was one, and some of the, you know, less civilized but not war zone types. And then there were two places that were 1-year tours. One was Korea, and the other was Vietnam. And my anthropology degree has a Far East emphasis. I had taken a lot of classes on various cultures of the Far East, including Vietnam. So I actually knew about Vietnam from a cultural standpoint much more than I knew about it from a political standpoint. And I really wanted to go to Asia. So they presented me with the possibility of going to Asia, something that I didn't think I could ever do on my own. And then they said, and a 1-year tour, which was, you know, which I thought, well, you can stand anything for a year. And I knew I didn't want to go to Korea because it was too cold. And then Vietnam, and I thought, well, this is perfect. I mean, I can go to Asia. I can go to Vietnam and do something for these guys that these idiots outside the window here are hanging in effigy, you know, and I can see what's going on over there. I can really see for myself what is going on over there. So I signed up, and I signed up specifically for Vietnam and said, you know, I'm only going to go to Vietnam. If you don't send me to Vietnam, then the deal's off.
Mm-hmm.
No problem.
So there was no hesitance on their part?
No, okay. They were thrilled.
Okay.
I'm sure they never dreamed that they would go to UCLA and actually find a live one to go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting issue. Were there any kindred spirits with you there at
Absolutely
UCLA?
None. Absolutely none. Not a single one.
Wow.
But in contrast to the rest of the campus, everybody was polite.
Okay.
That is, you know, these people were representing the Army.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody in the library school, you know, made any derogatory remarks or anything like that. And as far as I can remember, nobody made any derogatory remarks to me
mm-hmm.
when I did this. But I was the only one.
Mm-hmm.
I was the only one interested in special services anywhere and the only one to go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Now, just out of curiosity, can you assess, based on your time at UCLA, what percentage approximately of the student body was truly anti-war? I mean, was it almost everyone, or was there a significant silent majority that just kind of, you know, kept their heads down and plodded on through school and... There was a minority of loudmouths, if you will, that were...
Well, there were an awful lot of loudmouths, mm-hmm. and I don't know how many of them were actually students.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, a lot of these SDS demonstrators, I suspect, were not. Certainly, if there was any of us who felt differently, didn't open our mouths. So we were indeed silent, and we were, I think, very isolated. Now, of course, I was in a situation where I was in grad school, so you don't have the same kind of interaction as you do if you're an undergrad. I think that's probably true in most campuses. But it seemed to me that most people, at least, supported the concept of the anti-war movement, even if they were not as virulent or as violent as some of the protesters, and maybe didn't subscribe to all of their methodologies,
mm-hmm.
but in fact they still were not in support of that war.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, I just stayed away. I mean, I had not even what I would call an acquaintance at UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now I don't know a soul. I don't even remember the names of the people I went to library school with.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was a highly charged atmosphere there, and I remember at the end, I actually was taking they had a library computer class there,
mm-hmm.
and I was taking my punch cards in to run
mm-hmm.
in the administration building, and I had to climb over bodies. Literally, they were just stacked up just stacked up,
mm-hmm.
and they were trying to block people from getting into the administration building.
Mm-hmm.
And this wasn't just the SDS core group. I mean, there were lots and lots and lots of students who were laying flat on top of each other. And I remember climbing over them to get these things in, you know, because I wasn't going to let this keep me from getting this project done so that I could graduate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say that was a critical mass, because that was an awful lot of students. And it wasn't just the lunatic fringe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about the students in your library classes? These are graduate students, probably smaller classes, a little bit more interaction in the classroom, or was there?
Yeah, there was interaction in the classroom, but the interaction had exclusively to do with the course content.
Mm-hmm.
There were no active. If people were anti-war protesters in the library school classes, they were not actively doing it in class.
Okay.
So, I don't remember any confrontations there or feeling the need to like think, okay, I got to avoid this person completely at all. A lot of these people, and just like now, there were a lot of older people, you know, who were doing career changes. There were people who had families and they were going to school part time, you know. So and I'd say they were the majority. Part time students were the majority. Those of us who were going full time were not.
Okay.
And those of us who were 22 were not necessarily the majority either, which mirrors exactly how it is now.
Yeah.
So I think the focus was different. Now, these people were there because they wanted a career change or they wanted to get a degree that they hadn't been able to get or whatever. Anyway, that was what their focus was. And if they were involved in any kind of political activity, they weren't bringing it to school with them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what about your professors? Anybody use their position as a bully pulpit to espouse their own views?
No. Not at all.
Okay. Well, is there anything else you'd like to discuss with regard to your time in college there at Riverside and UCLA?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, when you finally were hired by U.S. Army Services, why don't you go ahead and discuss your transition into that organization? Where did you have to go for training? Or did you have any training?
Oh, no.
What happened?
Oh, no. Everything was... All communications were by mail and form. Mail and phone.
Okay.
They sent me the forms, I filled them out, and mailed them back. And then I got uniforms by mail, I got instructions about various things I needed to do, like get shots. I got my port call by mail. I did get one phone call from someone who I don't even remember who it was now, but I think must have been there or knew people who were there to give me some handy hints about the kinds of clothes to take and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it was all done by mail,
okay.
And I just took care of it all myself.
Wow. So you never left Riverside?
No.
You were to take care of all this?
No, I did it all in Riverside.
Okay.
I had the paperwork. I went out to March Air Base. The tailors out there altered my uniforms. The doctors gave me my shots. And I knew so many people out there that I showed them what I had, and they told me what I had to do to get onto the base and avail myself of the services. And then I got the port call, and I went up to San Francisco and took a bus to Travis.
Okay.
No orientation, no training, no nothing.
Except for that telephone orientation.
Except for that brief little telephone orientation, yeah.
Do you remember in that conversation you had with that person, did they discuss at all, how to interact with the Vietnamese people?
Oh, no.
Those types of issues?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No, that wasn't even discussed. Although that was probably something that I had more knowledge about than maybe they did. I did get that little brochure that they gave to all the guys, you know, the one with the red cover and the lady in the owl's eye on the front. And Special Services had another mimeographed brochure that they sent out that was really directed to service clubs.
Okay.
So a lot of it wasn't even relevant to me and what I was doing. And that was pretty much it. That was all that they sent that had anything really to do with, you know, interacting, you know, anything about Vietnamese or Vietnamese culture.
Okay. And why don't you go ahead and discuss the reaction of your parents.
Oh!
Told them that you had volunteered for this and you were going to Vietnam.
They were not happy.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, they had just managed to get my brother into the National Guard and were breathing huge sighs of relief that he wasn't going to be drafted. And then I walked in and I said I was going to Vietnam, and they were just stunned. I mean, they didn't throw fits or anything, and when it was clear that I wasn't going to change my mind, that was pretty much the end of the discussion, because I was 23 years old, and there really wasn't a whole lot they could say, and they hadn't had a whole lot to say about what I did anyway for the last several years. So, but they weren't happy. They weren't happy at all.
Now, were you still living at home at that point?
No. Oh, no. No, I left home when I was in, I guess, a junior in college.
Okay. And what did you think and what did you understand was happening in Vietnam, and why was the United States there?
At that time. Let's see. I guess I understood that we were there to help the South Vietnamese establish a democracy and keep the communists, and I think I thought of it as communists generically, not specifically North Vietnamese, but keep the communists from taking over all of Southeast Asia and Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And that all these soldiers were going over there to help the South Vietnamese have a democracy.
Okay. Had any of your conversations with your friends who had been to Vietnam and come back before you left, did any of those conversations cause you to consider or doubt that idea that that's why the U.S. was there?
No.
Okay.
No, although, again, if I had been able to ask the right questions
mm-hmm.
of my Marine friend,
mm-hmm.
there's a possibility I might have gotten a different perspective there.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're
but no, but no, that didn't happen. There was
okay.
there was nothing to make me change that
okay.
perspective.
While we're on the subject, it seems logical to address it at this time. How has that opinion or perspective changed?
Oh, completely. And it changed very swiftly after I actually arrived in Vietnam.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and describe that?
Completely changed. Well, I knew enough about Vietnamese culture that I should have known better before I ever got there.
Mm-hmm.
But, it wasn't, you didn't have to be there long to see that. The South Vietnamese were not a cohesive entity,
mm-hmm.
that they were not, they were not really a country, and that there was severe disagreement among the South Vietnamese about what should be done, that it was clearly a dictatorship, corrupt, that the Americans were doing the bulk of the fighting, and that the Americans were taking something and giving it back, and taking something and giving it back, and there was no forward movement, and that it was not at all what it appeared to be, and nor did it seem to me after I'd been there for a while that this concept of this steamrolling communist takeover of the entire Southeast Asian peninsula and down to Australia was even feasible.
Mm-hmm.
It was just very unlikely to happen.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have the firepower to do that. So, And because I did know something about Vietnamese culture, it also became more apparent to me that what we were in the middle of was a civil war, and it wasn't our civil war.
Okay. And that was the opinion that you developed very quickly upon arriving
yes.
in Vietnam.
Yes.
Has your opinion even been further refined or altered since then?
We never should have been there. We never should have been there, and I think there were people, I know I'm sure there were people in the Foreign Service who knew that, and they wouldn't listen to them. The civilians who were in DOD, you know, were just out in their own world and were paying no attention to what was going on here. They wouldn't commit to really fighting a war. They were trying to do it on the side. I think it was unconscionable what happened there. And, of course, people like me just were going along and saying, well, whatever the government says is right. So, you know, let's support them. And it was just a bad thing.
In that context, has your opinion of the anti-war activity that you witnessed in UCLA, has that changed at all?
My opinion of the anti-war movement has changed. I mean, I now work with people in various projects related to Vietnam who were anti-war protesters. I don't harbor any ill will at all. They were doing what they believed in, and that goes both ways. They don't harbor any ill will toward me either. I've come to find out that there were a number of women who went over with Red Cross and Special Services who were active anti-war protesters. I still am not happy that they chose to zero in on the soldiers. You know, you're protesting a government policy, and that's appropriate, but, you know, don't go taking it out on some individual private, which they did, although I don't believe the spitting incidents occurred, you know, but they did take it out in other ways on individuals, and I don't think that was appropriate, and that should not have happened. Those people were doing what they thought they should do, or what they were compelled to do, or else break the law as it stood then. And they were not policymakers. They were the ones on the line. And there was no reason to take off on them.
Well, we're really ahead of ourselves, but you mentioned something else that I'd like to ask you to clarify. You said you don't believe that there were spitting incidents.
No.
Given the number of GIs and American service personnel who have come back from Vietnam and they basically have referred to those incidents, how do you explain that?
It's an urban legend. It's the same as the barber in the wire. You know what I'm talking about?
The barber in the wire?
Yeah.
You mean in terms of the barber, the Viet Cong barber that works in the...
Right. And I had actually a personal experience with that one, with doing, as it happens, an oral history interview, except I was the interviewer, and this is a good friend of mine that I was interviewing, who was with service clubs, and she related the barber in the wire legend. And Quy Nhon during Tet, where she said that they had found the Vietnamese barber who cut her hair in the wire with a satchel charge. And so I said, oh, well, I said, well, did you see him? And she said, no. She said, but I heard about it. And then she said, and I heard about it after I came back to the States. I thought, okay. I was in California airports during the 60s. I saw lots and lots of soldiers in uniform traveling through San Francisco and L.A., where a lot of the incidents allegedly occurred. They were yelled at. They were ostracized. They were cursed at. But I never saw anybody actually spit, ever. Nor have I talked to anybody that I know personally who came through those airports. Now, I'm talking about the guys, mm-hmm. or even the women mm-hmm. who were in uniform, who were spit at. Mm-hmm. I just, and if I take the same approach, if somebody says, as I did with the woman I interviewed, mm-hmm. if somebody says, well, I know that, you know, they were spitting, and then I say, well, were you spit on? No. Well, did you see somebody get spit on? Well, no, but I heard it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm asking for this, your experiences and clarification, because I have interviewed people who claim and state, you know, rather coherently and with a degree of clarity the incidents involving anti-war protesters and that they as individuals were spit upon.
Maybe so, but
it's not just at times it's not just being spit on. It's other things that happened to some of them in terms of just ways in which they were mistreated.
I know they were mistreated. That was one of the things that mm-hmm. made me want to go over there.
Right.
I know that they were mistreated. Right. It's just that one particular thing which seems to have become the symbol for mistreatment.
Mm-hmm.
Or the icon for mistreatment.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not. No, absolutely, people were mistreated. That's the what I still have a bad feeling about the anti-war movement about
mm-hmm.
is that they did mistreat these people.
Yeah.
But the icon for that seems to have become spitting,
mm-hmm.
just like the icon for. You didn't really know who was a friend and who was an enemy,
mm-hmm.
is the barber in the wire.
Right.
And then the whole black syphilis icon.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe somebody was spit on, but I really don't think it was at the level that it...
Mm-hmm. Now, in the
stories would lead you to believe.
Mm-hmm.
Just like I don't think it's possible that everybody who says that they saw or heard about the barber in the wire, you know, can translate that back to an individual human.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm curious, when you were in the airports before you left and even after when you came back, and you did witness these confrontations between anti-war protesters and returning service personnel in uniform, did you hear anybody refer to them as baby killers? And
no.
That kind of stuff?
No.
When you say that they would yell at them. Do you remember how they would refer to them?
There was more cursing and slogans.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I heard.
Mm-hmm.
Or ask him, why are you going to that damn war? You know, why don't you go to Canada or, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And just cursing at them,
mm-hmm.
but I never actually heard a reference to baby killer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's see here. Why don't we go ahead and take a break for a moment? Once you discuss the trip over, when you left, where you left from, and your various stops or whatever on your way to Vietnam, and where you arrived.
I flew from Ontario to San Francisco Airport,
mm-hmm.
civilian airport, and then I took a bus from San Francisco to Travis Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
And then I flew, and it was the middle of, I actually still have the boarding pass, it
mm-hmm.
was the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, I think the flight must have left about 1 a.m.,
mm-hmm.
And I know my order said FUBAI, and there was a contractor who kept telling me that FUBAI was all right.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea where FUBAI was, and I actually never saw it the entire time I was there.
Mm-hmm.
But so I don't recall any other women on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
But there were other civilians, male civilians. But mostly soldiers. And it was a Braniff contract flight. So we flew from of course, I was dressed in this blue uniform with a straight skirt and the gloves and the hose and the pumps and the hat. Very practical for a 24-hour flight. And we flew to Hawaii, to Hickam. And then we flew to Guam, and then to Clark Air Base, and then to Tansanute. And we got to Tansanute, it was day, it was during the day. It must have been late morning, I think. And they opened the door, and, of course, everybody remembers the blast of heat that hit you when you... I was never as bothered by the heat as other people, because where I grew up, it was routinely 115 in the summer. And so I was used to very, very hot weather. The humidity was, I wasn't used to humidity, but I was used to very high temperatures. So the heat never bothered me as the way it did an awful lot of people. But, you know, after being cooped up in an airplane for that amount of time, you know, you definitely notice when they open that door and that tropical heat hits you. And then we all got off the plane, and, of course, everybody in uniform was herded into a group to go to get on buses to go to the replacement center. And the other civilians were contractors, and this must not have been their first trip, because, you know, they were, like, gone. So there I was. And I got myself through, you know, civilians were traveling, we were traveling on diplomatic passports. But we had to go through customs. And so I got myself through Vietnamese customs. And then I was on the other side, and there I was on the sidewalk, and there I was. And I had no names, and I had no contact numbers, and no idea where to go or what to do or who to ask for. So I was just kind of standing there and trying to think this through. And this Jeep pulls up with this soldier in it, and he says, are you with Special Services? And I said, yes. And he said, well, get in, and I'll take you over to the service club, and the ladies there will be able to help you get where you need to go. Well, now I can't believe I actually got in that Jeep, but I did. But sure enough, he took me right on over to the service club near the Massachusetts BOQ there on Kong Lee, going up towards Saigon. And there were Charmaine Lake, who actually I know today, who had been there, and I know now was there forever. She was there for years. She was running that service club, and she, knowing how things worked, would, every time a plane from the States landed at Tansanute, she would send one of the GIs that worked in the club with a Jeep over to Tansanute to cruise, looking for people in dark blue uniforms. This worked great for the women, because the guys came, and they were just in regular civilian clothes, so they weren't identifiable. But she knew that nobody ever knew when anyone was coming or who they were, and that anyone who came had no information about to get where they were going. So she would just send them over, and if they saw somebody in a dark blue uniform, they would load them up and take them over to the service club, and then she would find out where they were supposed to go. So I said I was at the libraries, and she called the library office, and they sent a driver out, picked me up, and took me to the Park Hotel. which was, now I know it was a couple of blocks from the Meyer Court BOQ, which is where everybody, special services people stayed, that stayed in the BOQ system as opposed to living on the economy. And So I guess by that time, I mean, none of this happened quickly, so nothing happened quickly in Saigon. It took hours to get anywhere because traffic was so terrible. So it must have been, like, late in the day, and, of course, I'd been up for, can't imagine how many hours. And so I guess they just booked me in there for the night because they knew that it was I wouldn't be able to process in at that point. I was too out of it, and it was too late in the day. So I basically went in there, and I took one look at the bathroom and the shower and decided I could live without a shower and went to sleep and slept, you know, for probably 12 or 13 hours. And then when the librarians came and picked me up the next morning and took me to breakfast at the Continental Hotel, I remember that, out on the they had and still have, it's one of the things that has stayed the same, they had a little garden area where you could eat, and took me to breakfast there, and then took me to civilian personnel office to process in. And then I got my billeting, which put me into the Meyer Court, so I didn't stay another night at the Park Hotel. And all the stuff you need, the ration cards and the card for the mess hall and the Geneva Convention card and the military ID card and, you know, just all of the bureaucratic stuff that you have to do. Mm-hmm. And then I went to the Meyer Court and got a room there. And the next day, they took me over and to the library, the headquarters area command library, which was just about a block and a half from the Meyer Court. And all of these buildings were located right next to the presidential palace. Mm-hmm. So it was right in downtown Saigon. And the librarian who was leaving was actually still there. There was actually some transition time, which was very unusual. But there was, so she was still going to be there, I think, another week. So she had actually had some time to show me where things were and teach me, you know, various things. Mm-hmm. And then she was gone, and there I was, running that library.
Okay. How long did you stay there?
I stayed there until the first part of October. I got there the last day of August. Mm-hmm. And I stayed at that library until early October. And but I didn't like Saigon at all. I wanted to get out of Saigon. So I asked for a transfer anywhere upcountry, just anywhere out of Saigon.
What did you not like about Saigon?
Oh, well, let's see. I didn't, the library director, the woman who was in charge of the whole library program, took me to the Cercle Sportif.
What's that? I'm sorry, could you?
Nobody's ever told you about the Cercle Sportif.
No.
The Cercle Sportif was a French tennis club. Mm-hmm. It had a swimming pool and tennis courts. And there were little Vietnamese ball boys running around in these uniforms that ball boys wear, you know, shorts, you know, very colonial. And you had to be dressed in tennis whites to play on these tennis courts. Now, I'm not a tennis player, so that didn't matter to me. And then there were all of these people from the expat community, lots of French and Americans, just sitting around in this dining room overlooking the pool and the tennis courts, you know, lunching. Mm. And I thought, this is not why I came here. Mm-hmm. the congestion and everything in Saigon was just horrible. Mm. And I just had this visceral feeling, you know, that this was not that much different from being in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And it just didn't seem, I mean, it wasn't why I was there. I didn't come there to party.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't come there to, you know, socialize in a French colonial country club. Mm-hmm. And I was just very uncomfortable with the whole atmosphere, and I just didn't want to be there. Mm-hmm. And I got very sick at first I had respiratory problems, but then I got cystitis, which was badly diagnosed. And they didn't give me the right kind of antibiotic, and they didn't give me enough of it. So it came back mm-hmm. really, really bad, to the point where they were talking about medevacing me to Japan. That's when they moved me out of the dispensary system and over to Third Field Hospital. Mm-hmm. And you know, I just flatly refused to go. And, you know, they gave me an antibiotic that worked, and they gave me enough of it to get rid of the infection. Mm-hmm. So when it was clear that, you know, I was going to get better, mm-hmm. I was getting better, then they dropped the medevac. Mm-hmm. And they never actually admitted me to the hospital. I was an outpatient, so I had to ride these army buses, the ones with the screening on the windows to keep mm-hmm. the grenades from flying in. Mm-hmm. From downtown Saigon out to Third Field Hospital, which was out in Tansanut, and, you know, this was like a 3-hour trip. So it was, and when you've got cystitis and you're bumping along on these buses, it was not pleasant, but mm-hmm. I just was not going to get thrown out of there barely a month after I've arrived. Mm-hmm. So all of this kind of came together, and I said to my supervisor, I said, you know, I really don't want to stay in Saigon. I really want to go someplace else. And at that point, they were moving the librarian in Cameron up to a new library they were opening in Chuat. Mm-hmm. And so they moved me to Cameron.
Now, how much did it cost to become a member of that French country club?
I have no idea. Okay. I mean, I was there, you know, because I was with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I never went back. Mm-hmm. Never. I mean, if anybody even suggested going there, they just made an excuse not to go.
Okay. And the library where you did work, what were your primary responsibilities and duties?
Oh, I was the director.
Okay.
There was nobody but me and all these local national employees and a few part-time GIs at night. And I did pretty much what I do where I am right now. You know, I supervised the staff. I bought the books.
Mm-hmm.
I don't buy books here. I set up schedules.
Mm-hmm.
I answered reference questions. I did, you know, I just did everything that you had to do to run a library, and including going out and yanking some of the Vietnamese, well, not the women who were the clerks, they were fine, but
mm-hmm.
the people they hired to clean is a universal problem. So, and of course, I didn't speak Vietnamese. I did speak French,
mm-hmm.
and at that time, a lot of Vietnamese spoke French.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was able to communicate with a combination of pidgin, French, and gestures.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much how I supervised the local nationals the whole year I was there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the cleaning staff were not what I would call enthusiastic workers. And
mm-hmm.
I would have to go, they would go and hide on the window ledge.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have to climb out and yank them in and, you know, say, you know, you got to do this and give them the broom. And so that was that. And, you know, I interviewed, you know, the part-time GIs were constantly transitory. So, you know, I would interview GIs for these part-time jobs. And, you know, just, you know, mm-hmm. I was the library director.
Okay. How many Vietnamese worked for you?
This was a pretty big library, and there were about 6 Vietnamese clerks.
Okay. How many cleaning people?
Oh, 2 or 3.
Okay.
It was a large staff. It was a long time after I came back to the States that I supervised the staff at large.
Mm-hmm. And how many American GIs would work part-time?
There were usually two or three.
Mm-hmm. Would they get paid for that?
Yes. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, it was a part-time job. Mm-hmm. They were on the payroll. And they were basically, they wanted an American presence there all the time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, I worked like 12 hours. Mm. But they would come in and cover the two or three hours at night that I wasn't there.
Okay.
And the weekend.
What were your typical operating hours?
The libraries mm-hmm. were open usually from, well, not different from here, usually somewhere between 7:30 and 8 to 10 mm-hmm. at night.
Mm-hmm. And how, what was the traffic like through the library in terms of your patronage?
There was a lot of traffic. It was in that library that I began to understand how many people were floating around Vietnam with no particular official reason to be there. There was a lot of usage by the soldiers. Mm-hmm. For one thing, it was air conditioned, mm-hmm. which even in Saigon, there was more air conditioning in Saigon than there was anywhere else. But even there, it was a fairly rare thing. Mm-hmm. So the fact that the libraries were air conditioned were a big draw in and of itself. So you would get people who would just come in to cool off for a while and read a newspaper or a magazine and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. People were reading. You know, like I said, the Meyer Cord BOQ was just down the street, mm-hmm. and the USAID office was just on the other side of that park where the palace is. And those people read, so they came in and took out lots of books to read. Mm-hmm. And there were some people, and then you would get people in from the embassy who were doing research for one thing or another, mm-hmm. You know, work-related research. The embassy wasn't that far away. So the clientele there was fairly sophisticated, mm-hmm. and made good use of the collection. But there were these people who would wander in because they read the sign and, you know, it said library, mm-hmm. and a lot of them were not eligible to get a card because they weren't military and they weren't connected to the military. But they were family members, and sometimes just people who had strolled in just to see what was going on. Mm. And I, you know, people say, well, you know, this isn't possible. People were very upset with the Casey, or I think that was her name, in China Beach, saying, well, how could this woman have gotten there? Well, it was simple. And people just don't realize it, because if you weren't in that kind of an environment, mm-hmm. you wouldn't really know. But people would go to Bangkok and get a visa and then just take a commercial flight into Tham Sanut.
Mm-hmm.
It was very simple.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people did that, and a lot of them wandered into that library. And some of them were family members and would get cards because they actually had a connection to somebody in the military. And some of them were just sightseeing or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But they, you know, they'd seen the sign and thought, oh, well, and usually I would let them use it. I wouldn't give them a card, but if they wanted to sit there and read a magazine, mm-hmm. I didn't stop them from doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very interesting. It was a well-used library.
Did you keep statistics on how many people frequented the library?
Yes, we did. Mm-hmm. We did counts. We did lots of statistics,
mm-hmm.
none of which have survived.
Why?
Well, they never came back.
Oh.
Or if they did, the archives hasn't opened the right box yet, because
okay.
none of the special services records survived.
Wow.
They were all the only thing that came back was material from the entertainment division.
Mm-hmm. When, why don't you go ahead and describe the holdings of the library in Saigon?
It was some fiction, lots of nonfiction, very current newspapers and magazines. It was not dissimilar to a public library. It was really a public library collection, except it didn't have, obviously, children's books. And a lot of the romance, you know, that type of fiction that you find in a fiction collection in the States. But, you know, there were mysteries in science fiction. There was current fiction. They subscribed, all the libraries in Vietnam, actually, the library program subscribed to a service called McNaughton, which was ran out of Brodart and still exists. Lots of public libraries get McNaughton books. What they were was they were rental collections. That is, the library service rented them from Brodart. And they were current fiction and nonfiction, the bestseller type things. And you would have them for 4 or 5 months, and then you would send them back, and you would get a whole new set. And it was, you know, revolving so that everything didn't go back and come in at the same time. So you always had a core collection of these McNaughtons, but they were constantly being old ones going out and new ones coming in. Now, the library service actually bought them once they came out of these freestanding libraries, made them expendable, and then sent them out to the field. But that was how you got current materials. And there was very current reading, and there was an emphasis on travel, on history, on arts and crafts type things, particularly photography. It was a good general core collection, good enough that soldiers who were taking USAFI courses, correspondence courses, for college degrees, had a decent chance of being able to do their homework from the material that was in these collections.
Mm-hmm. How many linear feet, approximately, do you know?
Oh, God. I have no idea.
About how?
I'm trying to think. How can I can compare it to something. The Saigon Library was strange in that it was housed in what had been a villa, and the woman who owned it had rented it to the military and moved to France for the duration. So instead of being like a single room, it was in the upstairs, and it took up several different rooms. Obviously, they'd been bedrooms. Mm-hmm. It's hard to get, unlike the Cameron Library, which was one big space. Mm-hmm. But it was, a little smaller than my house. My house is 1,600 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe 1,000 square feet.
Okay.
And that was the upper floor.
Okay.
Now, downstairs and in the back was the library service center, where everything that went out to the entire country was housed. And that's where they had the technical services area. That's where they cataloged their own books. They had a cataloger there and an acquisitions librarian and a countrywide shelf list. And lots of local nationals who type catalog cards. And that was also where they shipped out these kits. They had several different levels of kits that were composed of magazines and newspapers that they shipped out. I mean, and these really went out. These went to the landing, to the fire bases. And, if you hear somebody who says, well, I never saw a library in Vietnam, or I never saw any books, but they'll usually say, but these Playboys kept coming around. They remember the Playboys. Well, those all came from the Library Service Center.
Okay. What, did you guys have any particular thoughts on that? The fact that the library was distributing pornography?
Libraries? What do you mean? Libraries have always distributed Playboy.
For the articles.
No, the whole magazine.
Did you?
Oh, we have to keep it in microfilm here because we can't keep the hard copy together.
Right.
Oh no, libraries have always had Playboy on the shelf.
So it didn't faze you that you guys were distributing that to the GIs?
No.
Okay.
Not at all.
Okay.
Doesn't faze me that I'm distributing it now to the community college students.
Okay.
Librarians are, and as you say, there was a lot of, Playboy was indexed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the articles were indexed.
Right.
So.
Now, you mentioned that there was a shelf list for the whole country. Was there any kind of an interlibrary loan system?
Yes.
Okay.
I even got, I got interlibrary loans for some of these college guys that were taking college courses.
Mm-hmm.
From other USERPAC libraries. So I got them from Japan. I got them from Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. And you got them from other libraries in Vietnam?
Well, no, because the two libraries I was at were likely to be the ones sending them out more than getting them in.
Oh, okay.
Because we were the Cameron and Saigon were really the two largest libraries in the country.
Okay. How many books would you estimate in Saigon and then in Cameron?
In Saigon, I think there probably were maybe 15,000,
mm-hmm.
20,000.
Mm-hmm.
In Cameron, it was about half that, about 10,000.
Okay.
In the Cameron Post Library, that mm-hmm. was the biggest one.
And how about your periodicals holdings?
Well, now, I could actually give you a count on that. I didn't bring the thing, but I actually have a list of the periodicals.
Mm-hmm. Approximate.
Probably about 100.
Okay. Magazines, newspapers, different types.
Yeah, magazines and newspapers.
Mm-hmm. Now, to your knowledge, was there ever any preservation or archiving, especially of periodicals, in terms of, you know, once the library was finished with a particular edition and a new edition came out, did you guys actually...
We kept a back file.
You did keep a back file.
Yeah.
A backup copy of each periodical.
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't just keep current issue.
Oh.
Not
yeah.
in the freestanding libraries.
Okay. So you did keep all the back issues. Any
uh-huh.
idea where they went?
Hmm?
Any idea where they went?
You mean when everything shut down?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I actually know exactly what happened because I'm still in touch with the two women who packed up the Cameron Library.
Oh, okay.
They were told to box everything up and send it to Fort Leavenworth.
Okay. Interesting. Was included in those collections, do you know, Pacific Stars and Stripes?
I can tell you where to get the back file of Stars and Stripes.
Okay.
It's in the Library of Congress.
Okay.
And if you're really looking for it, they've got it, or somebody's looking for it, they've got a complete back file.
Okay.
The problem is it was unfindable for a long time because the record in the catalog
mm-hmm.
is incorrect. The location information is completely, totally incorrect.
Oh, no.
So I was down there,
mm-hmm.
and I persevered.
Mm-hmm.
And they finally turned me over to somebody who worked with serials,
mm-hmm.
and he led me to these old dusty shoebox indexes,
mm-hmm.
and we looked through those and we found the cards for Stars and Stripes,
mm-hmm.
and the location information was completely different from the information in the catalog.
Mm-hmm.
So then, with that new information, he went down in the stacks. And he said, yeah, it's all there.
Wow.
And he gave me a couple of microfilm reels to look at, and I took them and just scanned through them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've got a complete run of Pacific Stars and Stripes.
Okay.
But I can give you the good location information.
Okay, we can talk about that after the interview.
Okay.
Okay. But you did receive that as a publication then?
Oh, yes.
Okay. And those were shipped to Fort Leavenworth, probably.
Probably they shipped everything. I doubt that they did too. They were very discriminating about what they packed. I think they would pack everything that was there.
Mm-hmm.
But as happened with so many things in Vietnam, yes, we had a back file. But once we ran out of storage space,
mm-hmm.
we weeded.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So... So, you know, we always had a year's worth. Mm-hmm. But when there was no more room to stack the hard copy, there was no provision for retaining, mm-hmm. for retention, mm-hmm. as there was no provision for retention of any files. Mm-hmm. So basically we tossed them.
Okay.
And my understanding is that's what happened to all the files, too.
Okay.
That when the file cabinet got too full, they burned them. I talked to soldiers. I talked to, actually, they're librarians now. That's how I got in contact with them. But they worked in the USRV library office, mm-hmm. in USRV Special Services in Long Bend. And they've told me that's what they did.
Okay. Well, how were you treated as a woman serving in this capacity in Vietnam amongst so many American service personnel?
I personally had no problems with... I had problems, but it was all in relation to what I would call business issues. That is, I didn't have any problems with having to fend off GIs at any level, you know, who were not behaving appropriately. But I know that a lot of women did have those kinds of problems. But I didn't, mainly because I just didn't socialize. I didn't socialize at all in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to Cameron, we were billeted with the field grade officers. The arrangement for women in Cameron was there was a trailer court,
mm-hmm.
that was fenced off and guarded on a ad hoc basis. Mm-hmm. That is, they sent somebody up to walk the perimeter with an M15 at night, mm-hmm. an overnight guard,
mm-hmm.
thing. During the day, it was open.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the women, regardless of who they were, that is, there were women military there, mm-hmm. there were special services, there was Red Cross, there were civilians, third country nationals who worked for the PX, and if you were female and you were on the Army side, this is where you were.
Okay,
so I had a warrant officer, a woman warrant officer, for a roommate for a while. So the women were in a group of trailers, and then the rest of the trailers were all the light colonels and the bird colonels.
Mm-hmm.
And then the general had his own house. They built a house for LBJ when he was there in 66.
Mm-hmm.
And so the support command general had LBJ's house.
Mm-hmm.
So we, and the officers were okay. In Cameron, they weren't pushy and they didn't expect the women to socialize with them,
okay.
which I now know was somewhat unusual and for which I'm very appreciative.
Mm-hmm. What about in Saigon?
In Saigon, the Meyer Accord was a real mishmash. It was co-ed. That is, there were men and women in there. It was special services had a whole floor, or maybe even two floors there, because
mm-hmm.
it's where they billeted all the USO shows that were coming through.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a whole range of people who stayed at the Meyer Court. Everybody in special services, male and female, who didn't want to live on the economy stayed there. There were all these USO shows passing in and out, and then there were just military of all kinds, Army, Navy, and, you know, all of them were office workers.
Mm-hmm.
And there was really no interaction. Everybody went off to wherever they went during the day, and everybody worked 12 or 13 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And the mess hall, the field ration mess, was not in the Meyer Court. It was two blocks down at the Splendid BOQ. So there was a little snack bar at the Meyer Court. So there was no, you know, everybody got together and sat in the same place and ate.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody operated very independently there.
Mm.
And I think to some extent that was true. Well, I don't know about the other BEQs and the BOQs.
Mm-hmm.
At the time that I was there, most of the special services people were living on the economy. They weren't living in the BOQ. And at the time I was there, I was really the only special services person in the Meyer Court
mm-hmm.
who was living there. And I had ostensibly had a roommate, but it was a Thai soldier,
mm-hmm.
a female Thai soldier, who I never saw.
Okay.
She had uniforms in the closet. Of course, I was only there a month.
Okay.
But I never saw her. And now, after I left, there were a whole bunch of librarians who came in at the end of September.
Mm-hmm.
And they all lived in the Meyer Court, and they were all, I mean, they all formed a group.
Mm-hmm.
And they roomed together, and they had rooms next to each other, and that turned into an actual group.
Mm-hmm.
But that was after I left.
Okay.
So I didn't encounter when I perceive a situation as being something that I didn't want to be a part of, I just pulled away from it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when I first got to Cameron, I was invited to some parties at the airbase,
mm-hmm.
at the nurses' quarters, and they had a big patio-type thing there.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there. I went a couple of times, and I can't consciously remember, I can't remember why. All I know is I stopped going there.
Hmm.
Now, there was something there that I didn't like, or I wasn't comfortable, or something, but I stopped going there.
Mm-hmm.
And 25 years later, I met several nurses who were there.
Mm-hmm.
We were all there at the same time. They were Air Force nurses.
Mm-hmm.
Well, some really serious things were happening there. I mean, at least one woman was raped.
Mm-hmm.
There were real problems between the officers and the nurses there, and being compelled to be present at parties, whether they wanted, I mean, being ordered to be at parties, whether they wanted to be or not. All I can think of is that somehow some of this, I sensed some of this, or I saw something I didn't like,
mm-hmm.
and I just moved away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And I could do that. Nobody could order me to do anything,
mm-hmm.
as I kept telling the the officers in charge sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly they couldn't order me to appear at a party. So I had problems with the special services officers and the non-commissioned officer in the E7 in the special services office consistently. And but it wasn't sexual problems.
Okay.
They thought that here's this little 23-year-old girl, and they're going to tell me what to do,
mm-hmm.
in a business context.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, they couldn't. And they didn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they especially didn't like the fact that I had a vehicle. And in Cameron, everybody walked.
Mm-hmm.
But the library, the woman who ran the library program, knew, I mean, I had four libraries. I had two libraries on Cameron Peninsula and one right across the bay and one in Natrang. And my job was to do a circuit among all those libraries.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it was very difficult to get around. And you couldn't hop a helicopter from one end of Cameron Peninsula to the other.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you had to hitch rides, and she didn't want us hitching.
Mm-hmm.
So she bought bookmobiles. And that's what they were, Ford Econoline vans,
mm-hmm.
and they had shelves in the back, and it said Army Library Service on them, and she distributed those out
mm-hmm.
to, particularly to the upcountry library, so we would have a way to get around.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the special services officer had to walk,
mm-hmm.
and considered it a terrible injustice that a captain was walking while this 23-year-old girl was driving.
Mm-hmm.
So his mission in life was to get that vehicle away from me. Aided and abetted by his E7 NCO.
Mm-hmm.
So they just proceeded to try to make life as miserable for me as they could mm-hmm. to try to get that vehicle. Well, it didn't.
Good.
But that was the kind of,
yeah.
And you know, it was just the general attitude of, you know, well, you know, this little thing and this skirt, you know, what does she know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't need to pay any attention to her. And you know, it's the kind of same kind of
mm-hmm.
job discrimination that,
mm-hmm.
you know, exists even now.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to deal with it. I mean, I could discuss the situation with the people. My supervisor was in Longbend.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I could talk on the phone and I could discuss these things with her. But basically, there wasn't anything she could do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I had to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I did.
Mm-hmm.
But that was in terms of the soldiers, I never had a problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I never had anybody behave inappropriately.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was polite. Everybody was friendly. You know, they, once they got over the amazement that I was there,
mm-hmm.
you know, they were glad to have the service and, you know, they were just all, just very nice.
Okay. You mentioned earlier that you knew of some women who didn't an easy experience like that. I'm curious though, did you ever witness it personally, that where a woman was trying to fend off advances that were obviously unwelcome or anything similar to that?
Not with the nurses. I heard all that 25 years later.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, either in Saigon.
Yeah, no, I know. I did in Saigon.
You did?
Yeah.
Could you describe the incident?
Well, these they were mostly officers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, although the guy who killed Jitty Kirsch was a CM, so I don't think that, you know, that's one thing or another.
Mm-hmm.
They would just kind of muscle in, and particularly if the woman was younger,
mm-hmm.
and of course we tended to be the age of the enlisted men,
mm-hmm.
not the age of the officers, it was a big hall, it had to have been some sort of dinner, and there were a lot of people there,
mm-hmm.
and this one woman, and she was in, I don't think she was military, she was with somebody who was enlisted,
mm-hmm.
and because the men were in uniform, and she, you know, she was sitting there talking to him, and this officer just pretty much came over and pushed the guy away and sat down and put his arm around her and just like, you know, well, now you're mine. and she got out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she just moved away from it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was kind of the attitude. It wasn't, as I said, with those particular field grade officers in that particular camp,
mm-hmm.
not camp, but trailer court, but you would get the feeling from the officers that, you know, the women had a second lieutenant rating. This was supposed to give us some leverage with the Viet Cong if we were captured. Our Geneva Convention cards had our GS rating, and nobody was lower than a second lieutenant, regardless of the GS rating. And so, you know, while the women were officers, and so they could only associate with officers. And if you associated with enlisted men, you were fraternizing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I did encounter some of that. It wasn't again, a sexual incident or an attack.
Mm-hmm.
But I started going out with an NCO, an E5,
mm-hmm.
Who I actually subsequently married. But anyway, And the they didn't like the fact that I was being seen around the post with an enlisted man.
Mm-hmm.
And the general talked to me about it.
Mm.
And I said, I'm a civilian. The fraternization rules don't apply to me.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it says I'm a second lieutenant on a Geneva Convention card if I'm captured, I'm not a second lieutenant. I'm a civil servant.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't apply those rules to me, and I'm not going to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you push it, I'm going to file something with the Civilian Personnel Office because
mm-hmm.
I am not part of that hierarchy, and I am not, those rules don't apply.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he backed right off.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the end of the that was the end of that.
Mm-hmm.
But he, my boyfriend, had been coming to visit me in the trailer court, and we had to stop that
mm-hmm.
because the proximity to the living quarters of the officers.
Mm-hmm. So, were there any rules that you were given by your supervisors concerning your interactions with either Americans
no.
or Vietnamese?
No.
Okay.
We were given no, Special Services was given no rules at all.
Okay.
We had, which is different from Red Cross. Red Cross had a curfew.
Mm-hmm.
They had very specific instructions about how to act
mm-hmm.
That's actually, they had a week orientation,
mm-hmm.
and that's what it all consisted of.
Mm-hmm.
But no, Special Services, maybe it was, I don't know about the other sections of Special Services.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I virtually, except for my one encounter when I arrived in Saigon with the service clubs,
mm-hmm.
I never saw another service club the whole time I was there. The USO ran the clubs at Cameron. And I had some contact with some crafts people, but not after November of 69.
Mm-hmm.
So I really didn't know about what anybody was doing in any of these other special services groups.
Mm-hmm.
The librarians were different. The librarians all came in as GS-9s because we had master's degrees. The librarians were we weren't NAF, we weren't non-appropriated funds, we were career conditional, we were in the career program.
Mm-hmm.
Which was completely different from how everybody else was structured except for the very high-level people
mm-hmm.
in the other groups. So maybe there was more instruction given to the NAF fives in the service clubs,
mm-hmm.
than the GS-9s in the libraries. I mean, they treated us as if we were in the library in the States, or I mean, we were just part of the civil service,
mm-hmm.
and that may be why they didn't. We were expected to know that,
okay.
or we were expected to deal with it. I don't know. Actually, it's an interesting question because I've never actually talked with some of my friends now who were in service clubs,
mm-hmm.
whether they had any specific directions about that.
Okay.
No, nobody ever talked to us. We were expected to dress appropriately,
mm-hmm.
to know how to do our jobs,
okay.
with no supervision.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just expected to do that, and we were evaluated on it.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say dress appropriately, did that mean the uniform?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, when you were in Saigon, the only incident that you personally witnessed was the
one gentleman
coming, sitting down next to this woman, and
yeah.
she just left, and that was the end of it.
Yeah.
Nothing else.
A woman who worked in crafts, who was in Cameron, who I knew when I came to Cameron, and then she and the librarian both got transferred to Chulai. That was in October. In December, I went up there for Christmas to Chulai. And at that time, she told me that she had been attacked in her quarters,
mm-hmm.
and she had been able to talk the guy out of it.
Wow.
But she was clearly very distraught
mm-hmm.
still about it.
Yeah.
And it had only happened a couple of weeks before.
Wow.
Had you
seen anything while you were in Cameron? Or you personally witnessed anything? Or was that just, that was again?
No, in Cameron, there were no, the Red Cross women were out doing their thing,
mm-hmm.
and I had no idea then what they were doing,
mm-hmm.
but they were just out all the time.
Mm-hmm.
There were two Red Cross women who were not donut dollies. They were social workers, and they were in the office where the death notices and the birth notices. That's what they did, is they got Twixes from the states,
mm-hmm.
and then approved leaves and that kind of compassionate leaves,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of thing. So they were there all the time, and I was there all the time. But everybody else, they just kind of floated through.
Mm-hmm.
There was another woman who worked for entertainment, and she stayed sometimes in Cameron and sometimes in the Trang, because she depended on where the USO show she was escorting was.
Mm-hmm.
There was this Army warrant officer who was there for a time, but again, she worked somewhere, and she got up and went her way. And so we didn't... There was some socializing in the trailer court,
mm-hmm.
like we'd have barbecues every once in a while,
mm-hmm.
but it was usually just us. I mean, it was us. They wouldn't allow our enlisted friends into the trailer court.
Mm-hmm.
The officers kept their distance, and so it was just us. And usually it was just us, me and the two Red Cross women who were in the office,
mm-hmm.
and... maybe sometimes the warrant officer and sometimes the Australian woman who worked for the PX,
mm-hmm.
and that was it. So there wasn't any the parties seemed to take place at the Air Force,
mm-hmm.
and as I said I stopped going there.
Yeah.
I never went to the clubs ever. I never went to in Saigon or in Cameron. I never went to the officers' club, ever. So I wasn't in a group where I was ever, I just wasn't around where
mm-hmm.
those kinds of things might likely happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you know personally of women who got pregnant while they were overseas?
No. Yes. Yes, sorry. One.
Okay.
One.
Okay.
A librarian. Kay Wolfing. She met an Aussie.
Okay.
And she got pregnant. And this was right after I got there. Her
mm-hmm.
departure and my arrival were practically simultaneous.
Okay.
And she quit and went to Australia to marry this Australian.
Oh, okay. She wasn't forced to quit. She decided to quit.
My guess is she probably was. That wasn't mentioned to me,
mm-hmm.
but I would assume. I mean, that was absolutely against the contract.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't supposed to get pregnant, and none of us were supposed to be married. I mean, there were nurses.
Mm-hmm.
Nurses were allowed, military were allowed to be married.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were WACs there and nurses there who got married there or went with their husbands.
Mm-hmm.
But that was not true of the civilians.
Okay. You were required not to be married, and it was stipulated in your contract that you were not to get pregnant?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. And that
in other words, that was grounds for dismissal.
Pregnancy was grounds for dismissal?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Is there anything else you want to talk about with regard to your time at Cameron? I mean, Saigon, excuse me?
Can't think of anything.
Okay. Well, why don't we go ahead and talk about your transition from Saigon to Cameron?
Okay.
So you requested to be removed from Saigon, you got side of Cameron. What was your principal position and duties and responsibilities in Cameron?
Well, it was pretty much the same as Saigon, except this time I did it in four libraries instead of one.
Okay.
So I worked out of the Cameron Post Library, which was the biggest one. And then there was a small library at the Sixth Convalescent Center that had major personnel problems. And then mainly the GI that was assigned there spent his days getting drunk in the back room. So I had to get rid of him. And then I had a small library at 18th Engineers in Dong Bitin, and that was a combination library and tape center. And that tape center was the busiest place on post. I mean, I remember his name was Blair. He was the GI that was assigned to the library and the taping. And, I mean, he just spent his days taping his brains up. Everybody was ordering tape. This was, of course, pre-copyright. So, you know, they had this whole collection of out. I mean, and it was a structured, organized activity. And the Library Service Center bought all these albums, and then he made these tapes. And basically, the service was you had to provide your own tape. The library didn't provide the tape, but somebody bring in a blank tape, and they could select from this whole major list of recordings, and then he would make the tape. and you know, of course, everybody was ordering tape recorders from the catalog or the PX, and so they would have these tape recorders in their hooches, and the library was providing the listening. And it was very popular. I still have mine. I must have about 50 of those things.
Do you really?
Yeah. And so it was. The library was pretty tiny. That was a really tiny, tiny library. Maybe had 500 books. But the tape center was a bustling place. And then there was the fourth library was at Camp McDermott in the Trang. And it was probably about the same size as the 60C library, which was, maybe 1,000 volumes. And it was also very busy. The Trang, like Cameron, had lots of people who had a lot of free time. Cameron, because the transportation companies, hauled stuff up into the Central Highlands, to Bamituit. So when they were between convoys, they had a lot of free time. And at Camp McDermott, there was a lot of Air Force there. And when they weren't flying, they had free time. And there were, PSYOPs was there and military intelligence and just a lot of places that tended to keep regular office hours. So they had time. So the library was well used because it was a place to go. And of course, the patients at 6CC, they were in there because again it was a place to go. So these libraries were active. A lot of people were in them, and I did a lot of reference at Cameron. And the woman, the Vietnamese woman who essentially ran the library at Camp McDermott, she was very well educated too, and spoke English very well, and. When she would get asked questions that she couldn't answer, she would send them to me, so that I would do reference.
Do you recall what type of reference requests you received?
A lot of it was when guys would go on R&R. They wanted to find out about where they were going. So there were those kinds of questions. they would, there were a lot of ready reference kinds of questions. I mean, whether you need to know how to spell something, or, you know, or what does this word mean, they were going to go to school when they went back to the States, and so they wanted to find out information about about colleges in different places. You know, really very typical ready reference type questions. They needed a book. They just bought this camera, and they needed a book to learn how to use it. Some of them were interested in history, and they wanted to read about Vietnam. And we actually did bibliographies on those kinds of things. So they were pretty typical reference questions, typical public library type reference questions. And then the ones who were doing college courses, you know, they would have their specific homework-related questions. If they were taking an economics course, you know, they needed that kind of information. And if they were taking a history or political science course or a history course, they needed that. If they were taking English comp, they needed to do a research paper, and they had to pick a topic, and usually something that hopefully they would be able to get enough information from there to write the paper. So you'd have to think of something, you know, help them find something that fit that. So there are a couple of us who worked in libraries there and then came back and stayed with it in the States. Have said that, you know, the library work was not atypical at all. What we did in terms of the library really is no different than what we're doing right now. The difference was the environment that we were doing it in.
Okay.
Whereas I think the Donut Dollies and the Service Club women, you know, they were very much closer, I mean, closer to the guys on a personal level. We weren't.
Okay. At what point in your time in Vietnam, and in particular, I guess, you know, did it occur when you were in Saigon or later when you were at Cam Ranh, at what point did you realize that what we were doing in Vietnam, what the United States was trying to accomplish in Vietnam, was not quite what you thought it was when you left and went to Vietnam? When did that attitude or that perception for you change?
Well, it certainly started to change in Saigon because, I mean, that was one of the reasons I wanted to get out of Saigon, was because, you know, what I was seeing there just wasn't fitting in with what I thought was why we were there, that there seemed to be entirely too much, you know, fun and games, and not a lot of fighting war. I don't know that I made an immediate decision then that the whole thing was bad. But it certainly contributed to why I wanted to get out of Saigon. That, you know, this wasn't, you know, the atmosphere that I wanted to be in, and not the atmosphere that I expected to see. But it was more when I went to Cam Ranh, and Cam Ranh was an in-country R&R, and so guys would come down out of the field for 4 or 5 days, and also there were guys working, particularly in the sports program in special services, which was pretty much an all military, there were civilians connected to that, who were finishing out their tours, who had, you know, had been wounded or, you know, in various, and they'd been moved to someplace safer to finish their tour, basically, is what was happening. And so they had very different perceptions of what was going on. And I also became a lot closer to the Vietnamese in Cam Ranh. Now, the Vietnamese, the two Vietnamese women who worked for me in the library, who now live in Georgia, the ones who boxed up the books, They were certainly pro-American. I mean, their whole family had worked for the French and the Americans, and they wanted the Americans to be there, as did the woman in Nha Trang, whose family had come down from the north in 54. So it wasn't their attitude was very much like mine. But what was happening, and you know what was happening with their families, it wasn't fitting with what I was hearing from the government. You know, that clearly everybody, there was no forward movement here. Mm-hmm. And nothing was getting better for anybody. Mm-hmm. And there was just extreme amounts of corruption that everybody had to deal with. And that was Vietnamese corruption and American corruption. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't think even then I was so naive to think that, you know, this wasn't part of life. But all of this was just overriding anything about any altruistic activity in terms of why the Americans were there. Mm-hmm. Everybody just seemed to be running in place, and nobody was doing anything to move forward. Mm-hmm. And of course, I was there when Nixon announced the Vietnamization program, and the units started to pull back. Mm-hmm. So it just seemed to me that, you know, all of these people were dying, Vietnamese and Americans, and nothing was being accomplished. there was just nothing, and people weren't benefiting. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Vietnamese, the people that I knew were doing all they could to just kind of hang on in place. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they weren't benefiting from this, and you know, the prostitution and all of that was very obvious. I mean, certainly in Saigon and even around Cameron. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't seem like nobody's life was being improved by this. Mm-hmm. And you know, you start to wonder, well, could living under communism be any worse than what these people are going through now? And then came the Cambodian invasion. Mm-hmm. In April. Mm-hmm. And the 18th Engineers, I got a call that I had to come and close down that library. And I mean, like now, like come right now. Mm-hmm. So I did, and I said, well, where are you all going? And they were, you know, the convoy was already set up. Mm-hmm. And they were getting ready to go out. And they said, well, we're going to Cambodia. And just at that moment, on AFN, they were broadcasting Nixon's speech, the one where he said, we will not invade Cambodia. And I thought, that's it. Mm. I'm never trusting another politician again. Mm-hmm. That is it. Mm-hmm. And that was just sort of the crowning moment. That was when I thought, you know, we have to get out of here. This is a terrible mistake. And it's destroying the whole country.
Okay. Now, when you were in Saigon, did you have any opportunity, you know, people who were coming into that particular library, like you said, some American civilian personnel who were obviously working for the State Department and other American entities. Did you ever have a chance to talk with them?
No.
How about a camera? Similar?
No, no. There were no people like that in Cameron.
Okay. And do you know if your feelings in this regard were shared by anybody else in terms of, you know, the people that you work with?
Oh, yeah. They definitely were. Yeah. We talked about that.
Okay.
Yeah. The other people who worked for special services felt that way.
Mm-hmm.
We would drive around Cameron flashing the peace sign. That was the mode of greeting.
Hmm.
You know, you walk, people would, you know, just, and that, the soldiers and us.
Mm-hmm.
Pass somebody in a car, or in a vehicle, or walking down the street and say, flash, it was like waving hello,
mm-hmm.
flash the peace sign.
Did you see that this is somewhat ironic given the prominence of that symbol for the anti-war movement?
Oh, at the time I thought, boy, is this ironic.
Okay.
Even at the time I thought that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And in terms of your own training, you know, you mentioned earlier that you were schooled, in anthropology for Asia.
Mm-hmm.
For the Far East. What did you witness personally that made you conclude, and you put in the questionnaire, that you didn't think that our policymakers had even the tiniest grasp of the realities of life in Vietnam and appropriate policy to implement?
Well, the whole Strategic Hamlet
mm-hmm.
program
okay.
was a disaster
mm-hmm.
because they were ripping apart the whole Vietnamese culture is based on ancestral lands and honoring your ancestors and you know the fighting was bad enough in terms of how it was destroying, you know, the land.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, then you go and you yank people out and say, okay, you're gonna live over here now because it's quote unquote safer.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just completely removing them from, you're taking away the whole context of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And even the Vietnamese who worked for me would lament. I mean, the woman whose family had to leave the North, I mean, that was still a traumatic thing that they had to leave the land where their ancestors were, where their family was, and come south. I mean, she felt that she had to do that to save her life, but, you know, it was still a very traumatic event for her to have her family had to leave and come down here.
Mm-hmm.
And that was true with the women whose family lived in Dalat, because they had originally were in Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
And they had also had to move south.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I mean, even for the people who supported the Americans and you know, and were afraid of the communists and all of that,
mm-hmm.
you know, that separation was just a very difficult thing
mm-hmm.
to have their families split up like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew, I mean, I'd read Hickey's books, I read Village in Vietnam, and you know, long before I ever thought of going to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that this was wrong, and I couldn't understand why they were doing that,
mm-hmm.
because they weren't any safer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could see they were in as much in harm's way in these strategic hamlets as they were if they had stayed in their own villages.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't doing anything. They were moving them into these hamlets, and then they would go out and they would fight. And they might take that ground back, but then they wouldn't move the villagers back, and they would walk away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometime later, that was the other thing, too, when I would hear from the guys, you know, well, you know, we went and we took this, then these were the guys who were down on in-country R&R, and, you know, we took this hill, but then they told us to back off, and then, you know, the VC got it back again, and then a little while later we had to go and take it again. And this, and you know, I mean, this isn't the way to win a war, so you start to wonder, well, what are we doing here? Mm-hmm. Are we here to actually throw these people out or not? And if we're not, then why don't, and why can't the people in Washington work this out?
And
I still am not quite clear why they couldn't work that out, even now.
That is the policy of not holding ground, or?
Yeah, well, the policy of, yeah, of if you're going to fight a war, fight a war. Mm-hmm. If you're not going to fight a war, don't fight it. Mm-hmm. But don't just hang there in the middle and have everybody collapsing all around you.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you
and no understanding of how differently the Vietnamese or, I mean, Western Europeans think in a very hierarchical manner. And Asians, particularly Asians who are connected to Buddhism, or they think in a very circular way. And, you know, that it's two different modes of thinking. And if you don't understand that, you don't understand why Jop did and Ho Chi Minh did some things they did. Because if you're looking at it and you're thinking of it from your point perspective, it just doesn't make any sense at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem with Americans. Just generally. Americans are so embroiled in their own. And that was something that I really learned. I mean, if I didn't learn anything else from getting a degree in anthropology,
mm-hmm.
and I give a lot of money to UCR as a result because I think it's really changed my life, mm-hmm. is that there are different ways of different worldviews and different ways of looking at life, and yours is one of them, but it's not the only one, and it's not. Doesn't have to be the right one.
Mm-hmm.
There is no right one. There are many different worldviews and ways of approaching life.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can take yourself out of your own and look at other people's,
mm-hmm.
you not only can get on very much better with people from other cultures and other societies, but you're just a much better world citizen. And anthropology taught me that, to take myself out of my own worldview and my own culture,
mm-hmm.
and look at how other people approach things,
mm-hmm.
and not make judgments about it.
Okay.
And Americans don't do that very well.
Mm-hmm. Was there anything else that you witnessed that led you to question what the United States was trying to accomplish in Vietnam?
That was probably, and then there was this all the corruption that was going on. I mean, there was just so much corruption. You know, Americans selling stuff to the Vietnamese on the side, and the black market, and I mean, you couldn't get anything in the PX because it was all sitting on the street, and that I did witness. and you know, you would hear about, you know, selling Jeeps to the Vietnamese. Well, you know, if you're selling Jeeps to the Vietnamese, how do you know who you're selling them to? You know, you're selling them to the good guys or the bad guys, or are you selling to somebody who's a good guy during the day and a bad guy at night? You know, and the whole dropping off the back of the truck syndrome, where you would, you know, and the only way you could get stuff was by scrounging. So, you know, we all learned to scrounge, because if we needed stuff, that's what we had to do.
Mm-hmm.
There was no filling out a requisition, and it just left. I mean, at the lower levels, it was innocuous probably, but at the as you move further up and the stuff that you were trading in wasn't paint, but, you know, other things, and the home money issue, mm-hmm. you know, of and that was, you know, where they would all of a sudden say, okay, we've got a new brand of piaster. And I'll never forget that because they changed the currency right after I got in country. Mm-hmm. And all of these mamasons in the Meyer Court came running up to me and they wanted me to take their MPC. Mm-hmm. and give them new MPC, mm-hmm. because they figured I could change it in, mm-hmm. and so that was my first encounter with the currency, mm-hmm. stuff, and you know, it was just, and you know, I mean, I know all of this goes on in, it goes on now in the state, everywhere it goes on in other wars. But it just seemed like there was all this bad, and you weren't seeing any, you know, you weren't reading in the Stars and Stripes that, you know, they had done this, and it was real progress towards something. All you saw was, you know, this many of these bodies and that many of those bodies, mm-hmm. which is what they were saying in the States, mm-hmm. and after a while, all these bodies just are meaningless. But you're there, and you're not seeing anything that indicates that there is any progress toward a goal. Mm-hmm. That everybody is just kind of trying to stay, keep the head above water, and make it seem as if we're getting somewhere, but it's perfectly clear that we're not getting anywhere at all.
Now, were these sentiments at all shared by some of the GIs that you talked with who visited, who came in for their R&Rs at Cameron?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. There was a pretty much uniformly gloomy outlook on the whole thing, mm-hmm. certainly by the enlisted men.
And
it became gloomy, and the more into 1970 we went, the more gloomy it became, mm-hmm. when they started sending the units home, because the guys who were left were saying, well, you know, I may get killed here, and you know, it's all over but the shouting, mm-hmm. and, you know, mm-hmm. but I'm stuck here.
Yeah. What about the convalescent hospital? What was the typical length of stay for them, and did you have similar conversations with some of those?
Most of these guys were malaria patients.
Okay.
So, in fact, everybody who was at 6CC was destined to go back to the field, mm-hmm. because none of their injuries were serious. Most of them were malaria or some sort of an, you know, not a combat wound, mm-hmm. Infections of some kind of different kinds that weren't serious enough to cause them to be medevac. Mm-hmm. There were some there who were had some combat wounds, but not serious ones. Mm-hmm. Their length of stay was 3 months, maybe max. Mm-hmm. Now they were very skittish there because that hospital had been attacked right before I got there. In July of 69, some commandos periodically broke through the perimeter. Mm-hmm. They either swam across or they sneaked through. Mm-hmm. And there was probably one of the most serious incidents in Cameron, because they got through and they got to 6CC, and they rolled grenades and satchel charges down the wards. So when I got there in October, you know, they were showing me the bullet holes. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they disarm these guys, mm-hmm. when they're admitted. And they were, you know, so even though most of the guys who had been there during the attack had already rotated out by the time I was actually there, mm-hmm. that memory was still very fresh, and there was a lot of hostility and resentment at having to surrender weapons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were very alert and very watchful and about any possible attack. So, but they also, you know, they would sort of joke about, you know, well, maybe if I could make myself a little worse and then I wouldn't have to go back to the field. They were very, very pessimistic about the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, most of them weren't really going to do that. When they were ordered to go
mm-hmm.
back, they would go back.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't feel that they were doing anything positive there.
Were there many Vietnamese that worked in the convalescent center?
Yeah, there were local nationals all over the place. They had a huge local national civilian personnel office out there
mm-hmm.
at the Mika Bridge checkpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Huge Quonset hut, just
mm-hmm.
mammoth. Yeah, they would bring them. They weren't allowed. There was a small village, Cameron Village, that was off limits, and some people who worked on Cameron lived there, but it had been a fishing village and it was very small. So most of the people who worked on Cameron lived on the mainland and were trucked in and out. They lived in Benoit or Dong Bien or wherever, and they were trucked in and then trucked out at the end of the day. And there were huge convoys of deuce and a halfs
mm-hmm.
that would pick up, you know, come through and pick up all and pack. It was like the subway at rush hour. You know, the backs of these trucks would just be packed with local nationals.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a busing system, and they would bus them across the Mika checkpoint, and they had bus stops all along Highway 1. Some of them would go north towards Dong Bien and Nha Trang, and some would go south towards Benoit.
Mm-hmm.
And they just had regular bus stops where they would let them all off.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were lots and lots and lots of local nationals working there.
Did you ever witness any hostility on the part of some of the American GIs who had just come in from the field towards the Vietnamese nationals that they might encounter?
No.
Okay.
No, never.
All right, so this will end CD number one of the interview with Van Kelsey. All right. This is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Van Kelsey on the 27th of March. This is CD number two. Why don't we go ahead and discuss anything else regarding your time at Cameron that comes to mind?
Now, let's see. What happened in Cameron? Well, like I said, I met my first husband there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was right after I got there. And so we sort of dated
mm-hmm.
Until he left in June.
Mm-hmm.
And except for that, and of course, socializing was pretty constricted under the best of circumstances, and certainly constricted if it was an enlisted person.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we didn't do a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually worked in the motor pool. That's how I met him, because he had been commandeered by the previous librarian to keep the air conditioners going in the library.
Okay.
Did
he work on your van, too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, those were all TMP,
mm-hmm.
Transportation Motor Pool vehicles.
Yeah.
And what else happened in Cameron?
Were there many third country nationals, you know, Korean, Australian, did they come through?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I roomed with an Australian
mm-hmm.
for several months.
Mm-hmm.
She worked for the PX. Actually, there were no American combat troops in that area at all. The ROCs were in charge of maintaining that area around Cameron. So we saw Korean soldiers all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They would be riding through, and they were the ones who patrolled Highway 1 and the mountains
mm-hmm.
around that were immediately across the bay from Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't really start to see significant U.S. infantry units until you got up to Nha Trang.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a number of of Third Country Nationals,
mm-hmm.
Ian Cameron.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever meet any, personally?
Oh, yeah, the woman I lived with.
No, I mean the Koreans, I'm sorry.
Oh, the Rocks?
Mm-hmm.
No. No, no, they stayed, they didn't use the library.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't use the library, it was unlikely I would meet you.
Mm-hmm. What did you hear or what did you know about the Koreans?
Oh, they had a reputation.
Okay.
There's no question about it. A lot of people felt that Cameron was quite secure with the Rocks on patrol.
Mm-hmm.
And that they were a take-no-prisoner type and were had a reputation for being very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
And they certainly kept to themselves. And for the most part, there weren't a whole, well, my memory is there weren't a whole lot of incidents at Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
But my memory may not be so hot. My nurse friends kept telling me how many rocket attacks there were in Cameron in late 69 and early 70,
mm-hmm.
most of which I simply have no recollection of whatsoever. So I went to the New York Times Index, and I looked up articles on Cameron Bay
mm-hmm.
for that time period.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, they're right. There was a lot of reporting of rocket attacks on Cameron
mm-hmm.
in that time period. I don't remember.
Hmm.
I remember being on yellow alert a lot. There was a Cuban who was attached to special troops, and whenever there was a yellow alert, he would go running around screaming, "Yellow alert! Yellow alert!" So for whatever reason, that sticks to my brain.
Mm-hmm.
So we were at the higher levels of alert a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when they blew up the ammo dump. That I remember. That was that was pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably, except for having the bullet scooped by my head,
mm-hmm.
that was probably the most combat-related thing that I remember
mm-hmm.
in Cameron was the guys with the satchel charges broke through again and blew up the ammo dump, and that, you know, when an ammo dump blows, it's impressive.
Mm-hmm.
What I also remember about that night was, see, no one on Cameron was allowed to carry a weapon. You had to have a clear and present reason to have a weapon
mm-hmm.
before you were allowed to carry one in Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of the weapons were locked up in the company, what do they call those rooms, where the officer, the guard, officer of the day would be assigned. They all had cabinets, and all of the company's weapons were locked up in these cabinets.
Mm-hmm.
And they would only, you know, if somebody had guard duty, then they would be issued a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
If I had to drive to Natrang, the GI who was assigned to the Cameron Library had to go with me, and he had to check out a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
But you couldn't just walk around with a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So when there was an attack like this, nobody had a gun. And I clearly remember all of the yin-yang going on as everybody was running around trying to find the keys to unlock the weapons. Now, since this wasn't a concentrated attack,
mm-hmm.
and probably it was like two Vietnamese loaded down with satchel charges, and their goal was the ammo dump.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like they were breaking through the perimeter and launching an attack on the Cameron main cantonment area.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that everybody was having difficulty grabbing a weapon was not really an issue. But if it had been something like what had happened at 6DC, it would have been, and I think part of the problem and why everybody was so skittish at 6DC was because the same rules were in effect.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't have a clear and present reason to have a weapon, you didn't have one, and they were locked up in the company areas.
Mm-hmm.
So when you need one in an emergency, getting it is not a quick thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was a sort of another thing, like, what's wrong with this picture?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We're supposed to be there, and these guys are supposed to be in a war zone. Mm-hmm. And they're not giving me any weapons, but these guys are military. Why aren't they allowed to carry a weapon?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there were a whole lot of reasons. There had been racial problems there. There were drug problems there. And I guess the higher-ups felt that the chances of the soldiers shooting each other was greater than being shooting or being shot at by the enemy. And so, hence the rules.
Mm-hmm. Well, but, did you witness any of that yourself, that is racial tension?
I didn't witness racial tension. Well, it was very clear that the races were keeping to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The blacks had their area, and the whites didn't intrude on it. Whites had their areas, and the blacks didn't intrude on it. And except in very rare cases, there was absolutely no interaction.
Mm-hmm.
There were some cases, like the sergeant who in the motor pool was black, and most of the guys who were working there were white. But you know, they developed a camaraderie, and so they interacted, and on occasion, you know, if they were going to have a party or something, the Sergeant Spann always came.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a top sergeant out at 60C who was black, and there was camaraderie there too.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the exception. And when you were talking about just your run-of-the-mill GI, it was very clear that they were giving each other a wide berth. And I mean, I was in L.A. during the Watts riots,
mm-hmm.
and so I sort of recognized the signs,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't witness any actual confrontations. But I was told that there had been confrontations there several months before I came,
mm-hmm.
and they'd had to do essentially what you would call a lockdown.
Okay.
Now the drugs were pretty obvious, and again, there were two clearly defined groups. There were the drinkers and the druggies.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knew where the druggies congregated, and if you were wanted to be part of that scene, you knew where to go.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't want to be part of that scene, you knew where to stay away. And I was not part of that scene,
mm-hmm.
so I just had nothing to do with that, but it was certainly a problem in Cameron.
Mm-hmm. What were the more prominent drugs that you think were used or know were used?
I know they used marijuana because I saw,
mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure they were using heroin.
Mm-hmm.
Because occasionally, not often, but occasionally I would spot the needles on the floor.
Mm-hmm. And how would you rate alcohol use or abuse?
Oh, over the hill, over the top, high.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, we all drank.
Mm-hmm.
We drank far more than we should have,
mm-hmm.
and far more than I've ever drunk since. I mean, that was what you did at night.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that was responsible for, or that was the cause of any problems or anything else?
You mean in terms of
overuse or abuse of alcohol?
Now I certainly would consider it a problem. I mean, a lot of us, you know, walked away from there and didn't have the problem continue,
mm-hmm.
but you know, once we got out of Vietnam, mm-hmm. we didn't continue that particular habit,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of people did.
But did it contribute to problems while you were there? Did you see anything that, you know, did anybody become an alcoholic, obviously, have a difficult time controlling their drinking and stuff like that?
Well, everybody was drinking so much that somebody who was an alcoholic would just be one of the crowd.
Which fit right in.
Which fit right in, right. Nobody binge drank that I could see. I mean, the kinds of things that have gone on in the universities in recent years with sorority binge, fraternity binge drinking. No, everybody seemed to have a sense for how much to drink without poisoning yourself, but they would drink to that point.
Which would still be pretty drunk.
Oh, yeah, pretty drunk.
Well, it's an interesting analogy you just mentioned. That is the phenomenon on college campuses. And, of course, another aspect of the drinking problem on a lot of campuses is the issue of date rape and misunderstanding of, you know, what is consent, and can a drunk person truly consent?
Yep. And I am sure that that contributed to a lot of those kinds of problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, even women I've talked to, like the Air Force nurses who were attacked, it was in the context of that kind of environment.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I'm sure that too much drinking had definitely contributed to that. But when I was drinking with a very small, select group of people.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly, you know, the people who were in my trailer.
Okay.
So, and again, I just didn't go to the places.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, I wouldn't go to the enlisted men's club. I wouldn't go to the officers' club.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't go to those places.
Mm-hmm.
And I can only think that it was some sort of visceral understanding
mm-hmm.
that I could be putting myself at risk
mm-hmm.
by doing that, and so I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, some people had no choice. And some people didn't grasp, you know, what the implications might be.
Mm-hmm.
We would get our liquor was pretty much anybody could buy liquor
mm-hmm.
and buy beer, but it was rationed.
Mm-hmm.
So you were, and as were cigarettes. Well, I didn't smoke. I've never smoked
mm-hmm.
anything. You know, we would do trade-offs, like, you know, I would buy cigarettes on my ration card and for somebody and give them extra cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
And in return, they would let me buy extra scotch
mm-hmm.
off of their liquor ration.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this kind of bartering arrangement that would go on.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, I mean, I drink a lot of scotch.
And you never had a problem finding that? Huh?
No.
Plenty of scotch on the market?
Huh?
There was plenty of scotch?
There was plenty of scotch in the PX at Cameron.
Okay.
I can't exactly recall what the label was, but there was plenty of it.
Did, you mentioned earlier that, of course, one of the problems with black marketeering. What were the things that you found yourselves short of, typically?
Any kind of what I would call health and beauty aid,
mm-hmm.
you know, things like Band-Aids and soap,
mm-hmm.
Toothpaste, those kinds of things. Anything that was female related
mm-hmm.
would tend to would disappear mm-hmm. right away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you couldn't get Kotex, you couldn't get Tampax,
mm-hmm.
But you would see it in the black market. Sometimes they would get in a supply of hair dryers,
mm-hmm.
Not hair dryers, not blow dryers, those
mm-hmm.
didn't exist then, but
no.
actual little hair dryer things that had little bonnets on them.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they would get shipments of those in, and if you didn't have to happened to be actually in the building when it arrived, forget it. Mm-hmm. And you know, there weren't that many women there, so it wasn't like all the women buying out the stock. Mm-hmm. And of course, anything electronic, mm-hmm. you know, televisions, tape recorders, any kind of record players, anything mm-hmm. like that that came through, radios, mm-hmm. you know, those all just flew right out the door. So most of us, you know, we gave up on trying to buy any of that in a freestanding PX, and we would use that Pacex catalog mm-hmm. and order the equipment and then and have it mailed in.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned radios. Was that did you have your own radio? Was that important?
Yeah, I had a radio, and we had a TV in the trailer.
Mm. What kind of TV could you tune into?
AFN.
Okay. How about radio?
AFN.
What did you use radio for typically in terms of either entertainment or news or whatever?
Entertainment. Okay. Totally entertainment. Okay. I mean, they had an R&B show in the mornings mm-hmm. that I always listened to, and then it pretty much went over to country and western for the rest of the day, mm-hmm. and then they would have some other kinds of music, you know, rock or whatever mm-hmm. at night, and we listened to AFN a lot mm-hmm. on the radio, and the TV, they had a lot of PSAs. Mm-hmm. You know, the Saigon T PSA, the R&R PSA, Watch Your Back PSA. I mean, there was a PSA for practically every event or possible thing that could happen to you. The VD PSA, the malaria pill PSA. So all of these announcements were interspersed with either local programming out of the studio in Saigon, or tape shows from the States.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any shows that you remember in particular? That is, taped shows that were shown?
I think they had Laugh-In. Yeah.
Okay.
And I don't remember watching the TV a whole lot. We had it on. I know we had it on. But the signal wasn't always so great. Mm-hmm. But the radio, we listen to all the time.
Mm-hmm. And while we're on the subject of entertainment, did you you mentioned earlier that while you were in Saigon, you did stay in that particular building. A lot of USO personnel would be temporarily billeted there. Did you get to meet many? And did you get to see any shows, either in Saigon or in Cam Ranh?
No, I never saw a single show.
Okay.
Not one. I didn't, that was another thing that was completely off my radar. Like, mm-hmm. I knew they were out there,
yeah.
but I didn't pay any attention to them. And, which is really interesting given the fact that my roommate, that was her job, mm-hmm. to haul these USO shows all over Lower Tukor. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and I know they did a lot of shows in Cam Ranh, but it was just like, just not something that I paid any attention to. She did produce one play, Beyond the Fringe, mm-hmm. and they did it in the library.
Hmm.
So I was kind of involved with that, mm-hmm. and that was a local, you know, local Cam Ranh entertainment thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember seeing George Jessel in the Meyer Court right after I got there,
mm-hmm.
and thinking, what an asshole he is.
Why?
Oh, he was just treating everybody terribly. He was treating the Vietnamese that were working in that snack bar, you know, like they were, like, subhuman,
mm.
and not being very much nicer to the people who in his group.
Mm-hmm.
And just all around, I thought, gee, what a nasty person.
Mm. Did you get to meet any other celebrities?
I think some football players came through once, and she and Kathy brought them up to the trailer for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Ron Svoboda.
Okay.
Don't know. They're you're too young. And I was never into sports, so they weren't meaningful to me.
Mm-hmm.
I missed Bob Hope by about 4 hours in July.
Okay.
And That was about it. We did watch movies. Movies were a major source of entertainment. About the only thing, I mean, you had, at night, you had two choices. You could read, or you could read and drink, or you could watch movies and drink.
Okay. Any particular movies that you remember seeing?
Oh, I remember MASH.
Okay.
Now, they didn't want to show MASH. MASH came in country, but they were having a real big problem about actually putting MASH out for everybody to watch. So we got the special services in Saigon to send us up the movie, and they weren't allowed to show it on camera. So we all huddled into the special services office after dark, and we ran MASH, and we thought, and we said, this isn't Korea, this is Vietnam. No wonder they don't want to show this here. And I guess that after some point in time, that was not too long before I left. I guess at some point in time they released it. but it was so funny. We were sitting there in the dark because, of course, we weren't supposed to be in there at 10 o'clock at night. And it was basically the special services people, you know, the office staff and me and the entertainment people and watching this movie.
Any others that you recall that were particularly memorable for you?
No, that was it. What did we watch? We watched the Green Berets. I thought that was insane. Even the field grade officers thought it was pretty insane.
Okay. Well, I'm curious.
We were all jaded by that time.
Oh, were you? when we were talking about some of the violent episodes that occurred there, and your memory, you said, was kind of fuzzy on the rocketing.
Yeah.
You did mention, though, something about a bullet going by your
head. Oh, yeah,
You didn't elaborate, though. Why don't you?
For some reason, I was home. I was in the trailer in the middle of the day. I must have gone for lunch or something, because I wasn't normally there in the midday. But for some reason, I was there, and I was sitting on the bed, and all of a sudden, I feel this something like whiz by me. And then I noticed that there were, like, exit and entry holes in the wall. And I thought, what is this? So I went outside, and I dug around, and I found this bullet. And, you know, I mean, the normal reaction is to be, like, you know, scared or something, you know, to think that you'd almost died. But, you know, I mean, I knew that at noon, in the middle of the day, the chances of any VC snipers hanging around that part of Cameron Peninsula was so infinitesimal as to be impossible. So some fool GI had obviously aimed the wrong way. So I went stomping down to the general's office and said, you know, you better find out who was shooting their weapons off. And tell them to stop pointing at the trailer court. I wish I had kept the bullet. I gave the bullet to the general. And then after, I guess the next day, they called me and said, they were doing a mad minute, they were practice firing or something, and they had lost track of where they were aiming, and they had aimed in the wrong direction, and they were very sorry.
Okay. Any other friendly fire incidents while you were there?
No. That was my only friendly fire incident. I didn't even know it was called friendly fire then.
Do you know anyone who was injured or killed while you were there, personally? You know, people that you interacted with?
No. No one at all. Okay. The only person that I know who died while I was there was Jenny Kirsch, and I didn't know her.
And
I remember when she was killed.
You were there when she was killed?
Mm-hmm.
What were the circumstances surrounding that?
She was a donut dolly in Coochie, mm-hmm. and actually it was, the circumstances were eerily similar to my friends in July, mm-hmm. except with a much more tragic ending. A mm-hmm. Couple of GIs, well, some of this I'm saying because now I've read the CID reports. Mm-hmm. But what I knew then was that someone had come into her quarters in the middle of the night and stabbed her to death. Mm-hmm. And it was an American. Mm-hmm. And this happened in mid-August. And I was due to leave the end of August. Mm-hmm. And, the word percolated up through the in-country grapevine. Mm-hmm. That this had happened, and I must have heard it from the Red Cross women who were living in the trailer court, and the woman who was going to replace me had actually just arrived, and I remember sitting in the trailer and saying to her, "Boy, it's time to get out of here."
Did that help her morale?
Huh?
I suppose that did not help her morale.
Well, probably not, but she was career. She mm-hmm. was probably in her late 40s,
okay.
and she was a career librarian with the Army, and she'd been in World War II, and I mean, she wasn't somebody like me right out of library school.
Right.
So I think she probably had a better sense for all of this,
mm-hmm.
than I did.
Okay.
What
did you learn later through reading the CID report?
Well, there were probably two soldiers involved. They were both high on drugs. At the time, the women who were in the same quarters with her were not able to clearly identify which one of them was the one that was likely to have done the stabbing. One of them apparently was stealing, but may not, and the other one actually did the killing.
Mm-hmm.
But they couldn't make a positive identification. So in essence, it was completely inconclusive, and nothing happened at that point. But several years later in Wisconsin, one of them was picked up again for a similar assault, and when he was being questioned, he confessed to the Kirsch murder.
Yeah.
And he is in jail in Wisconsin now, not for the Kirsch murder, but for the one he committed in the States.
Mm-hmm. Okay. While you were in country, did you correspond much with your family?
Yes. Yeah, I wrote. They wrote. I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
My friends wrote.
Mm-hmm. What did you hear about what was happening on the home front?
Well, that's another whole area where my memory is a complete blank.
Oh, okay.
I don't remember what I wrote them. Mm-hmm. I don't remember what they wrote me, and my parents didn't keep any of the letters.
Okay. And were there any incidents involving wildlife? Do you have any problems with snakes or insects?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I shared the trailer with them. They were roommates.
Oh, okay. Snakes?
Oh, yeah. I was in a sand dune. Snakes, scorpions, centipedes, all those kinds of things that live in the sand.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they were all in the closet. And then, of course, we had, naturally, the kamikaze flying cockroaches that were endemic everywhere,
mm-hmm.
and rats, and we had a, because it was a trailer, and we had a bathtub,
yeah.
But we couldn't use it as a bathtub because these baby rats would keep crawling up the drain. So, you know, it really wasn't safe to sit. If you were standing and you saw a head peek out, you know, you could, like, just get out of the tub. And then we would scald them to death. We did have hot water in our trailer.
Okay.
More often than not. some of the other trailers never had hot water. Mm-hmm. But the one that I was in, sometimes we didn't have hot water, sometimes we didn't have any water at all, mm-hmm. but sometimes we did have hot water. So if we did, if it was one of those times when the water was hot, we would scald them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had this, well, these rooms were teeny tiny, and they had all regulation army cots in them. So once they got the bed in the little room, there wasn't a whole lot of room left.
Mm-hmm.
So I never actually was able to open the drawers. You know, they have these built-in closets and drawers and trailers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could use the closet, the upper part, but I was never able to open the drawers. But I would hear these things at night. I would hear all these noises.
Mm-hmm.
And I adopted the, if they don't bother me, I'm not going to bother them approach.
Mm-hmm.
But when I left, somebody opened the drawers, and there had clearly been a mini little war going on in there. It was between the baby rats and the cockroaches, and the cockroaches won. And then there was my experience in the transient quarters in Cameron when I first got there,
mm-hmm.
and I... There wasn't, the Aussie had friends visiting, and so I couldn't get into the trailer, and so I had to stay in this transit, in these transit quarters, which was just a wooden, you know, a wooden room, like all the guys lived in all the time, if they had someplace inside to live.
Mm-hmm.
And so I go in there, and the walls, all four walls, are like brown and moving. So I didn't understand the protocol yet. So I had a can of Raid, and I sprayed it on them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't realize that this was a very foolish thing to do because, you know, that just it didn't kill them, it antagonized them. So then they started flying around.
Mm-hmm.
So once they settled down, I figured out, you know, this again was a situation where if you don't bother me, I won't bother you.
Mm-hmm.
So they stayed on the walls, and I got in the bed and put the covers over my head and spent the night. I subsequently learned that hairspray was a better thing to use.
Hairspray?
Yeah. Apparently that just kind of weighted them down
mm.
and knocked them out.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Raid was just like, you know, did nothing. And the next day I moved into the trailer. I said, I don't care who your friends are, and I don't care. They can sleep on the couch. I'm moving in.
Mm-hmm.
But then the centipedes and the scorpions and that whole crew would normally just stay. If you didn't open doors, you know, you didn't see them. But about once a month, they would send up the Vietnamese to do a fumigating operation.
Mm-hmm.
So these Vietnamese would come up with their little cans, OD cans of DDT,
mm-hmm.
and they would spray the whole trailer. And we knew what was going to happen. So we would climb up on the furniture.
Mm-hmm.
Because they would usually do this on a Sunday, which was the only day that we were there.
Mm-hmm.
God forbid. I guess they didn't want to send them in when we weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
So we could sort of watch to make sure that nothing disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so we would all climb up on the furniture, and they would spray, and then this parade of creatures would walk. Again, the spray didn't really kill them. They were immune to it. They would come, and they would walk out of the trailer and down the stairs and into the sand. Snakes and centipedes and scorpions and all kinds of interesting fauna. But, you know, I mean, that's where you had to live, and you just had to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Any of the snakes poisonous?
Huh?
Were any of the snakes poisonous?
Oh, sure.
Wow.
Yeah. Just shook out your shoes. You had to be sure to shake out your shoes. But, again, I'd grown up in the desert, so I knew about this. And you know, we had black widow spiders and all of that. So I didn't grow up with them living in this house with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had to be careful in the garage and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
So, and if you kept shoes or anything like that, or gloves in the garage, you had to shake them out before
mm-hmm.
you put them on.
Mm-hmm.
So I was more attuned to this than some of the other people. But, yeah, you just had to shake the clothes out.
Mm-hmm. And what were things like as you were nearing the end of your tour?
Well, I was ready to go home. I mean, my boyfriend had left in June, and, you know, I had, and I was, you know, he was from New York City, and my plan was to go back and stop in California to see my family for a couple of weeks and then go to New York. So by that, after he left, you know, I was ready to go home. And after Jenny Kirsch was killed, I was really ready to go home. And, I mean, I kept doing my job. The job didn't change. But, you know, I had no desire to extend at all. And, although most of the librarians who came with me did, the only other one who didn't extend was somebody who had also met somebody and was going to get married. Mm-hmm. We were the only two who went home. Everybody else extended. But, you know, I had a completely different perspective than I had had when I came, mm-hmm. had come a year ago, and I was ready to leave.
Mm-hmm. What was the trip like when you left? What was it home? When you got home?
The trip home? Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I went to Japan. I spent 3 weeks in Japan,
okay.
which was possibly fortuitous, actually, because I had resigned in Vietnam.
Mm.
So when I processed out, I was no longer, you know, they owed me my trip back,
mm-hmm.
but I was no longer actually an employee.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have to leave in uniform.
Okay.
I left in civilian clothes, and I flew to must have been Yokosuka. And then took a train to Tokyo, and then I went on this 3-week tour of Japan.
Hmm.
And when I came back to Yokosuka to go home, I was actually on a plane of dependents. There was nobody on the plane back that had been in Vietnam.
Hmm.
It was all families of servicemen who were stationed in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so there were lots and lots of babies and kids and. And so it was a completely different experience from coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got to Travis,
mm-hmm.
I was just blended in as part of this dependent group,
mm-hmm.
to the point where they were supposed to take your passport away from you,
mm-hmm.
when you came back,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't. I still have it. I was part of this innocuous group of civilians,
mm-hmm.
and I went, and then I retraced my steps, took the bus back from Travis to San Francisco, and flew from San Francisco to L.A., and my parents picked me up.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there was absolutely no way to tell where I'd been. And so nobody talked to me, nobody bothered me, nobody,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was just, you know, just another girl flying
mm-hmm.
around California.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd had that 3 weeks to decompress.
Yeah.
In a completely different environment, you know, in a tour group again where nobody had been in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and they had all come over from the States,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't particularly. I don't think I said where I come from.
Mm-hmm.
I just joined the tour in Japan, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
do you think that helped?
Yes. Oh yeah, I think by the time I finally got back to my parents, I had, you know, I'd already been interacting with people for almost a month.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, lunch. I'd been interacting with people for almost a month,
mm-hmm.
outside of that context,
mm-hmm.
and where the subject wasn't even discussed. So I was already well prepared to operate in that environment. And, of course, nobody asked me anything about what it was like to have been in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
Did you talk with your family?
I was already well into the process of simply stuffing it way back.
Okay.
Well, no, neither me nor anybody else was
mm-hmm.
going to know about it.
Mm-hmm. Did you discuss it much with your family?
Nope.
They didn't ask?
Nope. Their major issue was, why are you only staying here 2 weeks? How can you come back after being away a year and only stay here 2 weeks?
Okay.
That was the major topic of discussion.
Uh-huh. Now, were you engaged?
Yes.
Okay. And you explained that to
them? Oh, yeah, they knew that. Okay. Yeah.
And so you left there after 2 weeks and went to meet your fiancé in New York?
Yep.
Okay. How long until you were married?
A year. We got married in 71.
Okay.
And we didn't talk about Vietnam either.
Really?
Nope.
You still haven't?
Well, we've been divorced since 78.
Oh, okay.
No, we never talked about Vietnam.
Did you ever feel that that was rather odd, or?
Not at the time. Mm-hmm. Now I think it's odd, although I've also learned that it's not that uncommon.
Mm-hmm. When you got back, what was California like, and in particular the, you know, what was the general attitude that you were experiencing from people that you interacted with concerning the war?
Oh, well, I didn't interact with anybody. I'd say that I saw my immediate family, and that was my parents and my brother.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather was very sick, and in fact, he died not too long after.
Mm-hmm.
Not too long after that.
Mm-hmm.
He was in the hospital, and everybody, you know, was very worried about my grandfather. And I believe that other than my immediate family, I only saw two people. That was my two close friends from high school and college.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them had babies,
mm-hmm.
and we were, like, on different planets. I mean, they were talking about their babies and their families, and I was sitting there smiling and not really, you know, just... But the subject of Vietnam never came up, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, I couldn't relate to what they were doing, and they couldn't relate what I was doing, and so, you know, they talked about their lives, and I listened.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents, definitely. I mean, nobody asked about it
mm-hmm.
at all.
Okay.
I mean, and their issues were, you know, why aren't you staying here?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when you went to meet your husband in New York, did you stay in New York for very long?
Yeah, actually, we lived in Brooklyn until 73.
Mm-hmm. And
then we moved to New Jersey.
Okay. The people that you met there, again, was it pretty much just not a topic of conversation?
Right. Nobody knew.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his parents knew.
Mm-hmm.
His family knew
because
mm-hmm. they knew how we'd met.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got a job, nobody knew.
Mm-hmm.
I put on my resume. I had worked for the Army, but I didn't put where I'd worked for the Army.
And they didn't ask?
No.
When you were applying for future positions, did you ever reveal that you served for the Army in Vietnam?
I do. I'd say since, I haven't applied for a job in a long time.
okay.
But I believe that when I applied for this job in 83,
mm-hmm.
that I put on it. Well, no. Yeah, I think I may have said Vietnam.
Okay.
But that would have been the only time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well,
on my current resume, it's on.
Mm-hmm.
Resumes that get used for grants and
mm-hmm.
that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's on there now.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not even sure. I may not have had it on even in 83. Because I really didn't, except for the very, very brief time in 75 when I was getting those people out of the country. I really didn't talk about Vietnam at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because of that very brief time in 75
mm-hmm.
that the assistant director at the library I worked at, whose son had been in Vietnam, she alerted me to the dioxin issue. Otherwise, I wouldn't have known about that either in 78, mm-hmm. because he had been called in for Agent Orange testing, and she said, you might want to know about this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what did you think of the when the Paris Peace Accords were signed in 1973?
Oh, I remember. That was right before we moved to New Jersey. We were still in Brooklyn because we moved to New Jersey in May of 73, and that was February. And I was just, I just sat and bawled. It just, I mean, I was glad that we were out, but it just, the whole thing just seemed so futile. And my husband wasn't there at that point. He was in a startup elevator company, and this guy and he had started a business, elevator repair, and so they were alternating being on call, and it was his night to be on call, and so he was out somewhere fixing an elevator, and I was there alone, and I was watching the television and just bawling. It was just, you know, that whole thing, just so futile.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think in 1975?
Well, 1975, that was, I had lost touch with all of the Americans I knew over there by 75, mm-hmm. well, by 70. By the time I moved to New Jersey, mm-hmm. I had no contact with any of the Americans that I knew over there. And then in 70, but I kept in touch with the Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. Now, we wrote, the two women in Cameron and the one woman in Nha Trang, and we wrote continuously the whole time. Mm-hmm. And in 72, one of the women in Cameron married an American soldier, and she had come to the States, and she was at Fort Benning. Mm-hmm. And her husband was in Korea. He'd been sent to Korea. And then in, I guess, March of 75, when things started to really fall apart. And, you know, she was frantic because her son, she had been married to a Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. And her son was there, because she hadn't been able to bring him over yet. And he was older. He was like 12. Mm-hmm. And her son was there. And, of course, her husband was in Korea. There was nothing he could do. And, you know, she called me, and we were both just frantic. And I contacted my congressman, and I wrote all these letters, and we got notarized letters of sponsorship, because she wasn't a citizen yet. And as an American citizen, had to sponsor these people, and, you know, we got all the names of everybody in the family, because we didn't even know where some of them were, because everything was collapsing. Mm-hmm. And the woman, the Trang, you know, that was over before there was anything I could do, and I still don't know what happened to her. Mm-hmm. So we wrote all these letters, and the congressman was faxing the, well, this is before fax. They were twixing the embassy, and I was sending telegrams, and, you know, I mean, we were all just doing all of this, and we had no idea what was going on. And then of course, April, whatever, 25th, you know, it was over, and, you know, we didn't know anything. And then in the middle of the night, about 2 days after that, after the last embassy, after that last helicopter left, I got a call from Guam, a collect call from Guam. Mm-hmm. And Lee, the one other woman who had worked for me, and one brother had gotten out.
Wow.
And they had all these letters that I'd written, and of course they couldn't do anything with the embassy, but they showed the letters to some people at Thompson Newt, and they smuggled them in the trunk of a car. And when they got to the helicopter, they showed them the letters, and I mean they were notarized. It was, you know, everything. Mm-hmm. And I'd also sent them some correspondence from the congressman, and they let them on the helicopter.
Wow.
So they got out, and the kids, Lee's two kids, and and Hans' son, they took, Lee took them to the Unlock Orphanage and Betty Tisdale's orphanage. And Betty, at that time, was married to a colonel who was stationed at Fort Benning. Mm-hmm. And she got them, and how she did it, well, the two, at least two children were tiny. They were young. But Stephen was 12, and the government wasn't allowing them to take anybody over 8. But somehow or other, she got him on the plane, and so, and they all three flew to Fort Benning. And then, of course, Lee had had to sign away custody in order to put them in the orphanage. Mm-hmm. And then when they got to Fort Benning, then Han had to prove that this was her son and her two, her niece and her nephew. But they all got out.
Okay.
Or those three. And then over the course of, in the 80s with ODP, we brought another, a sister and her two daughters over, and the youngest brother and his family over. Mm-hmm. So now everybody who wants to come has come. Mm-hmm. There are two brothers left who are Arvin, and you know they're not going to get out, mm-hmm. and their mother doesn't want to leave. Mm-hmm. So, but everybody in the family who wanted to leave is now here,
mm-hmm.
and I had about a file cabinet full of documentation
wow.
for these projects, but mm-hmm. we got them all out.
That's great. What was the most important thing you took away from your Vietnam experience?
To be a critical thinker when it comes to your government, and to be an active participant in what is happening around you, and not to just blindly accept what people tell you as the truth because they happen to be in a position of power.
Mm-hmm.
That's politically, that's mm-hmm. what I came away with. I came away with I very much enjoyed interacting with the Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
and even the condition the country was in then, you know, it still was a very fascinating country.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed that aspect of being there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that's part of why I keep going back there, because it's just a beautiful country, and the people are just, people who live there are just so nice.
Mm-hmm.
And friendly,
mm-hmm.
and I traveled enough while I was there to really get an appreciation for foreign travel. I mean, that was my first time that I'd ever been out of the United States, and except for a couple of trips to Tijuana, so I consider that to have been a definitely mind-expanding experience that I'm grateful to have had.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in terms of, I mean, I did things in Vietnam in terms of my work that I never would have done in the States, for years. I mean, you don't normally walk out of library school and be in charge of four libraries, and,
mm-hmm.
So I got a lot of experience there, and that has, stood me in good stead over the years. I have never had an experience in a library in the States, and that includes rioting gangs, that I felt was something I couldn't handle. I mean, if you were going to survive there, you had to learn how to handle things,
mm-hmm.
and to be able to operate independently, and to be able to make a decision, and sometimes a fast decision, but in any case, to make the decision and be responsible for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very positive thing. Some of the people who work for me may not feel that way, but I think in terms of a career, I got an awful lot out of it.
Okay.
the bad side, of course, was being, you know, being where people are killing each other and seeing the effects of war on a population and seeing the effects of war on the people who are fighting it. Mm-hmm. Although I think I've seen more of that in the last 10 years than I did when I was there.
Could you explain in what context?
Well, now since I'm not heavily involved in veterans, you know, veterans groups and veterans mm-hmm. issues, you know, I see now the, you know, the sickness and the physical sickness and the mental sickness and, you know, the kinds of things that, you know, happens to people. And it's just very sad.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I just keep waiting for my personal health repercussions. I mean, so far I've been very either fortunate or lucky or whatever mm-hmm. that I don't have any health problems.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the women I know who were there do,
mm-hmm.
and some of them major and severe
mm-hmm.
And life-threatening.
Mm-hmm.
I made some decisions. I mean, I made a decision to not have kids because of the dioxins thing. And so I had a tubal ligation in the early 80s. I don't take estrogen, even though I had, and I shopped around until I find a doctor who isn't going to laugh at me when I talk about dioxin exposure.
Mm-hmm.
So there are those issues, and mm-hmm. of course, any time something can happen. But so far, nothing has. So,
I'm just curious in terms of your potential exposure to dioxin. What makes you think that the area you were in was heavily?
Saigon was one of the most heavily sprayed areas. People don't realize that, but if you look at the spray maps, it's because lots of times they had to jettison the spray as they were landing, and so people who were in the Saigon Lung Bin Benoit area
mm-hmm.
could have significant exposure,
mm-hmm.
and. Then there was just the spraying that went on just to clear the perimeters. You know, I mean, like they were using DDT to kill the bugs in the trailers. Well, when they wanted to flatten down some weeds, they would use herbicides to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The spray maps indicate that while there was no actual aerial spraying on Cameron Peninsula, there was substantial spraying in the mountains just across the bay in the time period that I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the episode at the Kokomo reunion last fall where a bunch of us all brought our slides and we were sitting in the motel.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there were about four or five of us and we all were showing our slides. And one woman's husband, she was in service clubs, and he was in Vietnam, too. He's clicking through these, and he says, "Hey, that looks like an Agent Orange drum." And so we went back, and sure enough, she had a picture of the Kool-Aid. You know, they would go out when they would have all the, they would serve Kool-Aid.
Mm-hmm.
So the Kool-Aid urn was sitting right on top of the Agent Orange drum.
Mm-hmm.
And then we all started to look. And in every one of our slides, even one of mine out at 6cc, we started to identify the Agent Orange drums because they had those very distinctive orange, they were rimmed in orange.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously the government wouldn't say if you were in Vietnam, you were exposed to dioxin, and you don't have to prove it if it weren't overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
So I just, and some of the women who have had the most major dioxin-related problems, and that has traveled down into their children, were WACs stationed in Saigon.
What when you talk about symptoms or diseases that some of these women are suffering from, could you be more specific?
Various cancers, spina bifida in children, thyroid, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, in the men, prostate, diabetes, type 2 diabetes. It's incredible the number of women I know who are in Vietnam who have type 2 with diabetes, and incredible how many women I know in the general population who don't. I know one woman who wasn't in Vietnam who has type 2 diabetes, and I know about a dozen women who were there. And I think actually the VA is just about ready to certify that one, or if they haven't already. Various things that could easily be dioxin related but haven't been certified by the VA, like ADD, ovarian cancer.
Just out of curiosity, do you know if any of these women have actually had the dioxin levels checked?
Yes, and the military women are being compensated.
Do you know what their levels are?
No.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to discuss?
I don't think so.
We've covered an awful lot. If you had to do it over again, would you go back?
Yeah, because the reason I went was to support the troops, and I think I did that, and I'd do that again.
Okay. Well, if you don't have anything else to add, I'll just go ahead and end the interview here.
Okay.
This will end the interview with Ann Kelsey on the 27th of March.